Crop FM, Ausgabe Nummer 461. Wir schreiben den 21. Mai 2021 und mein Gast heute Abend ist Robert Guffey und es geht um die hohe Kunst der Verschwörungstheorie. Und wie immer gibt es den CropCom, jenen Live-Chat, mit dem man sich live heute Abend am Gespräch beteiligen kann, erreichbar über die Website von CropFM, CropFM.at, CropFM.at, einfach einsteigen, Fragen reintippen und ich gebe sie sehr gerne an meinen Zoom-Gast Robert Guffey weiter. Und natürlich gibt es auch die Skype-Leitung, einfach User CropFM anrufen und einfach all die Fragen an Robert selbst stellen, auf die ich nicht komme. Wo immer man diese Sendung hört, sie verteilt sich ja über alle möglichen Plattformen im Netz. Ein Besuch auf cropfm.at lohnt sich auf jeden Fall. Dort findet man alle Sendungen in bester Qualität mit allen Hintergrundinformationen und noch einiges mehr, zum Beispiel auch die CropFM News, von denen ich immer ein paar Auszüge zu Beginn der Sendung bringe. Und ebenfalls auf der Seite der Link zum CropFM Forum, die, ich sage mal, Alternative zu Facebook aus den 90ern. Und die großartigen Ankündigerbilder von Matthias Töpfer findet man natürlich auch nur auf der Website, auch das heutige wieder, ich liebe es. Mehr von seiner Kunst auf atelier-töpfer.de, wem diese Sendung gefällt, bitte weitersagen, verlinken, wo immer nur es sinnvoll erscheint. Und wer diese Sendung unterstützen möchte, der kann das sehr gerne tun, indem er mich mit interessanten Leuten zusammenbringt. Oder auch pekuniär spendet, und zwar findet man den CropFM Spenden-Button auf der Startseite, der orange Button mit dem Herz. Und an dieser Stelle, es gab wieder ein paar sehr großzügige Spender. Ganz, ganz großes Danke und auch an die Dauerspender natürlich. Also ganz, ganz großes Danke, die ja schon was beigetragen haben. Danke. Obama über UFOs, der war unlängst auf James Corden, glaube ich, heißt der Mann. Wir wissen nicht genau, was das ist, hat er gesagt, zur allgemeinen Belustigung von allen, aber er hat nicht gesagt, dass es das nicht gibt. Und nicht nur der Ex-Präsident, auch Navy-Angehörige, das Pentagon und die CIA überschlagen sich fast mit Aussagen zu einem Thema, das jahrzehntelang offiziell gar nicht existiert hat. Obwohl es immer wieder Untersuchungen gab, wie zum Beispiel das berühmte Robertson-Pendel schon in den 50ern. Da kam man aber zu dem Schluss, dass es hier nichts zu untersuchen gäbe. Obwohl die Zusammenfassung des Berichts dem eigentlichen Inhalt sogar widersprach. Aber wer liest schon den Bericht? Aber egal, ne? Read the transcript. Jetzt soll alles anders werden, oder wird es das? Seit 2017 gibt es da immer wieder Stellungnahmen und Aussagen zu UAPs. Doch von Louis Elizondo, Tom DeLonge und der TTSA ist mittlerweile kaum mehr was zu hören, oder? Aber im Juni soll es ja eine Stellungnahme der Geheimdienste geben und vielleicht kommt es ja jetzt, die große Offenlegung auf die alle warten. Zeit wäre es schon lange. Aber ob diverse Institutionen, die jahrzehntelang nur Desinformation und Falschmeldungen, ich meine nicht nur, aber ja, mehr oder weniger, zum Thema UFOs verbreitet haben, ob die jetzt plötzlich mit der ganzen Wahrheit herausrücken, ist für mich mehr als fraglich. Aber ich kann es natürlich auch nicht ausschließen. Ich meine, wäre super. Und ja, und dann natürlich die jüngsten Aussagen von einem Dr. Stephen Greer. Ich habe es gerade kurz vor der Sendung verlinkt. Ich habe noch eben nur die ersten 5 Minuten gesehen und habe gewusst, okay, das passt irgendwie auch zur heutigen Sendung. Also, denn im Gespräch mit Robert Guffey geht es ja heute auch natürlich um Verschwörungstheorien vor unser aller Augen, die dennoch kaum jemand auffallen oder irgendwie interessieren. Naja, das Thema UFOs interessiert natürlich jetzt einige und das gehört da absolut dazu. Ja, und hier geht's gleich weiter mit Robert Guffey, ein hervorragender Autor und auch ein sehr sympathischer Mensch, wie ich finde. Und Invisible Conspiracies, jetzt gleich auf Crop FM, Don't Touch That Dial. Robert Guffey is a lecturer on the University of California for English, and he's also very much into all those strange things going on in the world. Hi, Robert. Welcome on my show.
Hello. Thank you for having me on.
Great to have you on. As I said, a couple of years ago, a friend pointed me to your book, Camellia, or maybe not even a couple of years, like 1.5 years or so ago. And then Chris Marks, he actually then, and Camellia was a wonderful read. And I also read Cryptoscatology. Wow. I can absolutely recommend this. I mean, a very deep analysis. It's funny and it makes you shiver. And, yeah. So here we are. And yeah, Camellia, of course, is also a book we will talk about. But first of all, you're a 32-degree Mason. So how can we trust a single word you say? I mean, you're in on it. Come on. That's ridiculous. Yes,
that's well, that's true, of course. But in fact, the Freemasons seem to play a large role in the QAnon narrative, given the fact that the QAnon narrative goes back, the elements that make up the QAnon narrative, in fact, go all the way back to anti-Masonic literature in the late 1800s. You know, there was a fellow named Leo Taxel who wrote a book called The Mysteries of Freemasonry back in the late 1800s. And it was very popular. In fact, it was popular for about 12 years. Roman Catholics loved hearing scary stories about what the nasty Freemasons were doing to people in underground grottos in France. And people would fill up lecture halls to hear Leo Taxel talk about this story. He had concocted a piece of fiction about a woman named Diane Vaughan, who actually didn't exist, but she was the sort of whistleblower at the center of this early conspiracy theory about Freemasons. And Diane Vaughan, you know, there were all these wild claims of this woman who shapeshifted into a reptile and then played the piano at a Masonic lodge, and, you know, there was demon worship, which is funny because the whole David Icke scenario of shape-shifting lizard people, that goes back to Leo Taxil as well. And so Leo Taxil continued this hoax for well over a decade, and then finally had a press conference where he admitted that the entire thing was a piece of fiction, in fact, a piece of satire, satirizing how gullible the Roman Catholics were in desperately wanting to hear any kind of crazy story that was negative about the Freemasons.
But maybe they just made him say that because he spilled the beans he had to kind of, you know, take it back a little bit.
Well, in fact, this is also similar to the QAnon narrative in the sense that no matter what you do, it weaves back into the narrative. So it doesn't matter what sort of logic or evidence you have to the contrary, whatever it is just becomes part of the narrative. And so, in fact, that is exactly what they said when Leo Taxil came out and said, listen, this whole thing was a hoax. There is no Diane Vaughn. I made it all up. In fact, he called it the most fantastic hoax of our era, something like that. I'm paraphrasing him. And that was, in fact, the exact reaction was, well, someone must be threatening him. And in fact, to this day, Leo Taxil's book, The Mysteries of Freemasonry, is quoted by Southern Baptists and far-right evangelical Christians. In fact, there's a pamphlet that I remember getting in high school. I started collecting these little pamphlets that I would find on bus stops or just tossed away in, on sidewalks, and they were by a cartoonist named Jack T. Chick. And Jack T. Chick, in fact, was probably the most successful independent American cartoonist of all time. But he was sort of a far-right loon, evangelical Christian who would draw these little rectangular black comic books. And each one, in a stranger and weirder way than the last one, would talk about, you know, what's going to happen to you when you go to hell if you're a Mormon, or if you play Dungeons and Dragons, or if you celebrate Halloween. And one of them, in fact, was about the mysteries of Freemasonry. And he quotes extensively from the Leo Taxil book in his little pamphlet about the evils of Freemasonry. My favorite Jack T. Chick pamphlet is the one about Mormonism, which features the classic panel of two Mormons at the door, and you see a Christian woman peering out through the curtain at the two Mormons, and the thought balloon above her head reads, "Gasp, it's Mormons." So to this day, evangelical Christians still quote the Leo Taxil book as if it's fact. So the whole idea of a conspiracy theory beginning as satire, but then turning into something that is interpreted as real, goes back 100 years or more. And in fact, there are even more recent examples of that, which I talk about a little bit in the first chapter of Cryptoschatology. By the way, I should point out that cryptoschatology is a word that I made up. Crypto is Latin for spirit, and scatology is the study of feces. So it's the study of secret feces, and that's what I do. That's if they handed out PhDs in cryptoschatology, then that's the degree that I would get. So in chapter one of cryptoschatology, I talk about various forms of conspiracies, and I break it down into five categories, which is insanity, disinformation, misinformation, satire, and legitimate research, you know, real conspiracies, because of course there are actual conspiracies going on all the time. Every day people are being convicted of conspiracy charges, so it's not like there are no conspiracies. But I thought it was important in chapter one of cryptoschatology to kind of map it out and categorize it, and of course there are overlapping, in other words, there are some conspiracy theories that overlap and merge many of these categories into one. In terms of the whole satire aspect of it, there is Leo Taxil's The Mysteries of Freemasonry. And of course, most infamously, there's the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, which was originally a satire called Dialogue in Hell, which was published in 1865. And it was a satire about Machiavelli, and it was plagiarized in the early 1900s, like around 1905, something like that. And it was turned into this anti-Semitic tract, which then the Nazis later used as their main, you know, text to prove that the Holocaust was necessary. There's a wonderful graphic novel by Will Eisner, the great comic book artist. Will Eisner wrote and drew a graphic novel. In fact, it was the last graphic novel he ever published, called The Plot, which goes into great detail about the history of the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, and how, in fact, it did start as a satire and then later turned into something that was interpreted seriously. And then, of course, it appears again in Behold a Pale Horse, the William Cooper book, where he suggests that you simply cross out Jew and insert the word Illuminati, and then everything's okay. According to William Cooper, the only inaccurate thing was that it said Jew, you cross it out, put in Illuminati, and then everything will be fine. And then another one more recently was a Report on Iron Mountain by Leonard Lewin, which was published in the 60s. And it purports to be an actual internal memo written by government insiders about how to keep the economy going, and that there were these various stratagems that they had waiting in the wings. And one of them was to fake an alien invasion. And that by
now
faking
that sounds
an alien,
familiar, doesn't it? I mean, well, Stephen Greer talks indeed about it in his last broadcast.
Well, that it's interesting because the guy who wrote, Leonard Lewin, who wrote Report on Iron Mountain, later came out and said, because on the original edition it says edited by Leonard Lewin, and he claimed someone else wrote it. But later on he came out, he admitted that he wrote it, and it was intended to be a satire. The funny thing is that L. Fletcher Prouty, who, you know, if you've seen the Oliver Stone film JFK, you'll remember a character named Mr. X, played by Donald Sutherland. Mm. That character is L. Fletcher Prouty, who wrote the book The Secret Team and worked in the Kennedy administration. L. Fletcher Prouty read Report on Iron Mountain, and he told Leonard Lewin, it's amazing if you made all this up as a satire, because I remember the young hotshots in the Kennedy administration saying these exact things when I was there in the early 60s. So there you have an example of, just because something's a satire doesn't necessarily mean it's not true, because L. Fletcher Prouty was basically claiming that Leonard Lewin, though he made up a satire, sort of accidentally hit on what was actually being discussed at the time.
Which often happens. I mean, literature often, even by chance, hits on things that are true. I mean, many examples.
Sure. Well, there's a long history of that in science fiction. Another subject I go into in Cryptoscatology, Chapter 5, is all about science fiction. Back during World War II, when the atom bomb, the Manhattan Project, was underway, of course it was top secret, a lot of the people working on the project didn't even know what they were working on. It was so compartmentalized, they didn't know they had been working on an atom bomb until the day it exploded.
You can't keep such a secret.
Hmm? Right. Yeah, exactly. The comic book artist, Jack Kirby, who created Captain America and the Fantastic Four and the Hulk and all these characters, he had written a comic book story about splitting the atom and the destructive after effects of this. And I heard an interview with Jack Kirby that was done back in 1992, about 2 years before Kirby died. And Kirby said that he had been reading an obscure magazine, and I would love to know what magazine it was, but he said he had been reading an obscure magazine where there was an article about Nikola Tesla, who was still alive at this point, and that Tesla had been thinking about what would happen if you split an atom. And so Jack Kirby took that article about Tesla and turned it into this comic book story. And then as a result, he got a call from the FBI. The FBI dropped by, and they wanted to ask Kirby, how the hell did you know all this stuff? Of course, Kirby immediately thought, well, that's weird, you know. I mean, they kind of tipped their hand in terms of keeping it a secret.
Yeah.
But Kirby just, you know, got angry. Being a New Yorker, just got angry and, like, threw him out of the office. And there's other stories of that happening in World War II, science fiction writers publishing something that was a little too close to the Manhattan Project and then getting a visit by the FBI. And supposedly the same thing happened to Phil Dick. The very first person to ever interview me about the book Camellia was Tessa Dick, Phil Dick's widow.
Wow.
She has a radio show called Ancient of Days. And she was the first person to interview me about Camellia. And she told me about how when Phil Dick, his house was broken into when he was living in Southern California in the late 60s, early 70s. And there was a big write-up about it at the time in Rolling Stone magazine. And Phil Dick felt that he was being surveilled, harassed. And this turned out to be true. And he came home one day and found that his whole apartment had been ransacked. Nothing of value had been stolen, but all of his papers had been, his file cabinet had been blown open, and his papers had been stolen. He was then told by the local police, you better get out of Dodge because it's not safe for you to remain here. So he took off for Canada. And then while in Canada, he gets kidnapped. But by the way, this is Tessa Dick. This is all from Tessa Dick. He gets kidnapped by these two men in black types who shove him in a car, and they ask him if he'd be willing to put secret codes in his science fiction novels. And they said that all, you know, he'd get paid, and all he'd have to do is just insert these codes into his novels. And he,
why would he? Why? What would be the purpose of that? So, were these magic spells?
Apparently, the purpose, no. Apparently, it was a way of embedding information in a text. So, in other words, it was like a he assumed that what it was some sort of covert means of communicating.
But what an odd way to communicate! I mean, you have to read the whole book till you get to this passage, and I mean. There is, I think, the first part of Men in Black has something similar. So the guy reads some Pulp Fiction, magazines, and says that there is some real information in there. But yeah,
what's odd about it is that you know, because at first that sounds very bizarre, and one wonders if you know, it actually even happened. However. There is documented evidence of this having occurred to Anthony Burgess, who wrote A Clockwork Orange. There's a book, a biography of Anthony Burgess, and in the book, the biographer, which was recently published, the biographer talks about Burgess being approached by government types who wanted him to put little codes into the book that he was working on, which turned out to be A Clockwork Orange. And according to the biographer, unlike Phil Dick, Burgess was like, okay, I'll do that.
And you mentioned science and science fiction and especially satire that then suddenly gets turned into something completely else. I mean, Adrenochrome, for example, might be, or obviously is one of those examples. So I didn't know. And there's a great series of articles. I have linked up the first part. I think it's a 5-part series that you wrote on QAnon, and absolutely recommended reading, I would say, especially to someone who never really dove into QAnon. I mean, I read a little bit of it and I just went, well, okay. I mean, that's obviously a psyop, but a lot of people I know, and a lot of smart people, I mean, interesting people, intelligent people, apparently, they're into this stuff. And same happened to you. And Adrenochrome, I didn't know that this comes out of, or I forgot that this, because I've just seen the movie, I've never read the book, but apparently that's from Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. And yeah, you're right, I remembered now. There's a brilliant film by Terry Gilliam I can absolutely recommend, and apparently the book is also quite good, but I don't know it. So this comes out of this, yeah, I mean, obviously a satire movie, a satire book, and then people just take it for real, and then it goes on from there.
Well, yeah. In fact, regarding Hunter S. Thompson, well, before I get to Hunter S. Thompson,
maybe we could go into QAnon a little bit, because what did you find out about what the frack is QAnon? I mean,
okay. Before I answer that question, but my head tends to go off into 12 different directions at once.
I know.
Just in order to wrap a ribbon around.
So I tried to steer you a little bit here and then, but I totally enjoy your going off into all kinds of directions. So don't get me wrong.
The reason I brought up Phil Dick was because soon after that experience of getting abducted by the Men in Black and stuff, he ends up in a mental, like a psych ward, or he has kind of like a bit of a breakdown due to all this stress, and he ends up in a hospital in Canada. The guy in the bed next to him is a ex-military intelligence guy, and Phil Dick is telling him about all the stuff he's just been through, and his house is broken into, and nothing of value was taken, but his files were taken. And this military guy goes, oh, it sounds like, he goes, you know what I bet happened? I bet you wrote something in a science fiction story that was true, but you didn't know it. And so they were looking to see if there was any evidence that you were colluding with the enemy or something like that. And the guy said, have you written anything that might be considered sort of subversive in that way? And Phil Dick was like, oh my God, you know, he'd written like 60 books by that point, and you know, 100 short stories. So he had no idea.
And all of them subversive in a way, aren't they?
All of them, yes, absolutely. But there was one particular story that he thought might have been the one that caused this attention, and it was a story that was in the book Dangerous Visions, edited by Harlan Ellison. And the story he wrote was called Faith of Our Fathers. And it was a story that postulated a world in which mind-altering substances were being surreptitiously put into the water supply to keep everyone inside a pre-arranged reality, you know, so that everyone was living in this shared virtual reality world, a matrix type of world, but they didn't know that, you know. And Phil Dick thought that was a story that caused all this attention. But anyway, so if that's true, then that's a then that's an example also of a science fiction writer hitting on something and then, you know, causing the government to come in and investigate him as a result of something that was not intended to be taken literally. But again, that ties in perfectly with Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, because and Hunter S. Thompson, because I have a theory that the whole adrenochrome section in Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, which you can see in the Terry Gilliam film, at one point in the book, which says, you know, nonfiction journalism on the side, the main character, Raoul Duke, which is based on Hunter S. Thompson, is there in the hotel room with his Samoan attorney, Dr. Gonzo. And Dr. Gonzo is roughly based on a man named Oscar Zeta Acosta, who was an attorney in real life. And the Dr. Gonzo character says that he was representing a Satanism freak, and his client couldn't pay him. He couldn't afford to pay him for his services. So instead, he paid him in this adrenochrome, which they say is this chemical taken out of the human body, harvested from a living human body from the pineal gland, and that if you ingest it, it can give you like the highest of highs. And of course, in the movie, you see them take it, and that gives Terry Gilliam, the director, the ability to do whatever the hell he wants. Because
and then he sees reptiles. I
mean, oh yes, there are. Yes, that's right. There are lizard men and lizard women.
Yeah.
in the casino. my theory is where Hunter S. Thompson got this idea from is the fact that adrenochrome is not an actual recreational drug. It's a chemical that appears in the human brain, that is manufactured by the human brain naturally. And I know from having read the collected letters of Hunter S. Thompson, particularly Volume 1, Proud Highway, he mentions in there all the books that he's reading. You know, he's in his early 20s, and he's reading all these books. He mentions reading Aldous Huxley's Brave New World. So I think it's safe to assume that he might have read Brave New World Revisited as well, which is the follow-up book that came out in 1958. It's a collection of essays which everyone should read. The spring semester just ended here at CSU Long Beach, where I teach, and as my midterm, I assigned four chapters, chapters 4, 5, 6, and 7 of Brave New World Revisited. And those particular chapters are amazingly prescient and apply to now. And in one of those chapters, I can't remember, it's either chapter 4, 5, 6, or 7, Aldous Huxley dedicates a paragraph to talking about adrenochrome and its function in the human brain. And I have a feeling that Hunter S. Thompson read that and kind of misinterpreted what Huxley was saying and thought that it was a drug that you could actually take. And then that leads to the phantasmagoric sequence in Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, which is then later taken up by the QAnon narrative and woven into that as well. The whole sequence of articles I wrote for Salon about QAnon, it all grew out of, it was around March. It was just after the lockdown. And I was talking to an old friend, and he's in his late 50s and lives in the Midwest. And he starts talking about how COVID-19 is going to be this positive development in 2020. And I asked him, well, what do you mean by that? And he starts telling me, in very sincere tones, about how when Trump is reelected in 2020, Trump's going to give us all free energy. He's going to abolish the income tax. United States troops were at that very moment, they've been deployed underground where they were going to, they were cleaning out covert subterranean tunnels and saving hundreds of children from being satanic slaves and, kicking out what he called, quote, the black hats. This is an exact quote. Trump will have to use the emergency broadcast system to give this news to the American people because the media keeps lying, and social media like Twitter and YouTube are censoring and deleting videos that report reality the way it actually is, unquote. And he told me with absolute certainty that there were Trump supporters working behind the scenes who he called the white hats, and that they had wrested control of Google from devil worshippers, which is why you can now retrieve, you know, accurate information from Google about all of this. So I decided to test that theory, and I Googled everything that he was saying, and all I would find was a bunch of Q posts saying exactly that. So it was a kind of like weird feedback loop of confirmation bias where QAnon begins in November of 2017. The first Q post was late October, early November 2017, when, by the way, Donald Trump was at his lowest approval ratings. I find that interesting that QAnon pops up when Donald Trump is at his lowest approval ratings. And supposedly Q was this secret agent with top Q clearance, which is supposedly a clearance that's used by people who work for the Department of Energy, this Q intelligence agent was supposedly posting all this accurate information on 4chan and then later 8kun about all this secret information about the Satanists and children being abducted by the Illuminati and dragged underground and fed to demons. And it got really wild. So when my friend is telling me all this, I thought he starts sending me these links and these QAnon posts and videos. And I immediately detect something that I don't think would be obvious to anyone who hadn't been intimately familiar with conspiracy theories for the past three decades, which I have been. I wrote my first article in 1996 when I was 24 for Paranoia Magazine, issue number 12. So I'd been involved in all this for a long time. And so I immediately noticed that most of the elements that make up the QAnon narrative, the QAnon mythology, have clearly been pilfered from previous sources, some of them going back to the late 1800s, such as Leo Taxel's The Mystery of Freemasonry. The stories about abducting children, taking them underground, all that stuff, you find elements of that in Leo Taxel's stories. You find it in the stories of Richard Shaver. Richard Shaver and
Shaver Mystery. Palmer. Yeah. And thanks, by the way, you sent me some links to Long John Nabel. Wow. I never really listened to a lot of his shows, but since I'm a diehard Art Bell fan and this guy inspired Art Bell, well, and he talks about the Shaver Mystery. And yeah, so these things, they're really old. They all actually seem to start around at the 1870s, 1890s, by the turn of the century. And now it seems somebody took all those stories, cooked them up with some contemporary myths and what have you, and is now serving it again. And it works.
Particularly what's the parallels with the Shaver Mystery is interesting is because Shaver would publish something, Ray Palmer, who was the editor of Amazing Stories, would publish Shaver's stuff, rewrite it, publish it. Then readers would write in and say, this ties into this. And then they would take whatever the readers were saying and then add it to the narrative and keep it going for a very long time. The Shaver Mystery was extremely popular for about 10 years, in the 40s. And clearly the Shaver Mystery draws upon earlier influences like the fiction of H.P. Lovecraft, for example. Mm. And so it was this sort of, the Shaver Mystery was sort of participatory. The readers were participating in it. So it's sort of an early example of a LARP, of a live action role-playing game, because many of the readers would then go out to the locations that Shaver had identified as being the locations of these portals to the inner hollow earth, where these beings, the Daros, detrimental robots, lived. And the Daros would often kidnap children, take them underground, torture them in weirdly sadistic ways. There's one wonderful illustration of a naked woman strapped to this wheel, and the Daros are like throwing darts at her.
I just wanted to say, you get the same stories today, but then of course you also get real, I don't know, ritual abuse.
That's one of the interesting things about the QAnon thing is that I noticed a pattern, and the pattern was that they would take a conspiracy theory, the original content of which was essentially anti-fascist at its core, and flip it. So now it was the same theory, slightly altered, but now it was pro-fascist, pro-conservative, pro-martial law, and then ultimately pro-Trump. And I saw this over and over and over again. One of QAnon's primary sources is a book called Operation Vampire Killer 2000, which is this booklet that was published in the early 1990s. It was published in, I think, Phoenix, Arizona. And it was published by an organization that called themselves Police Against the New World Order. And the main guy who ran it was a guy named Jack McClam. And it was an organization of ex-law enforcement officers. And these guys were libertarians, but they weren't pro-Republican. In fact, they were far from it. One of the main purposes of this pamphlet is to warn people about factions in the government using a fake crisis to declare martial law, taking us back to Report on Iron Mountain. And these guys were, they were libertarians who were opposed to militarizing the police. And they were opposed to fascism, and they were opposed to the Republican Party. Again, this book comes out like around about like 91, 92. And within a few years, these libertarians kind of morphed into the militia movement of the mid to late 1990s. And so for decades, these people have been concerned about imminent martial law. Then in November of 2017, when Trump was at his lowest approval ratings, Q suddenly appears and begins posting messages and photographs on 4chan that seem to indicate that that this person has access to the White House. And in fact, I think that that's true. I think Team QAnon did have access to the White House. And within weeks, the same group of people who had been so concerned for decades about secret concentration camps suddenly just spun around 180 degrees and decided that, no, martial law is actually a good thing, because Q told them it was going to be the damn liberals that will be put in the concentration camps, not the right-wing Christians. So it's okay now.
Yeah.
And I found that to be fascinating, to be able to convince thousands of people to reverse these deeply held convictions in the matter of weeks because of anonymous posts, on 4chan. I mean, that's absolutely incredible.
And I mean, everyone who read those posts, and some people in the chat, we got a chat running here, they obviously are not really following the show, and their comments seem to indicate that they think that we are arguing for QAnon. So see how those things work? I mean, things just get turned around all the time. So we're definitely not.
This happened on recently on Twitter. Salon had a guy, a journalist who works for Salon, interviewed me about after January 6th, and asked me, you know, what's coming up with QAnon next. And so I started telling him, well, this is the next deadline. This is when they claim that Joe Biden's going to be, you know, pulled out of office, and Trump's going to be put back in his place. And this is what they're saying. And a guy retweets it and then tags the university where I teach and said, you've got this pro QAnon guy working at the university. What's wrong with you?
Really?
And you think, you think, what, is there absolutely just no reading comprehension here? I mean, all you have to do is read it to see that I'm talking against it, not for it.
Yeah. What you do is you just show what's going on there. I mean, out of the shadows, you do a brilliant analysis of this propaganda piece. I've never seen it. I don't think I will ever see. I'm ever going to watch it, because I now know pretty much what's in it, and it's a great example of a piece that has like 10% real information there about MK Ultra and stuff like that, and then tons of complete bull.
Well, I focus on Out of Shadows at one point simply because it premiered, I think, in April of last year, right after the lockdown. It took the internet by storm. It's essentially a QAnon recruitment video, though QAnon is never mentioned at any point during this documentary. It purports to be a documentary about Hollywood intelligence activity in Hollywood. In other words, you know, using Hollywood as a propaganda arm of the intelligence community, which is actually a valid subject matter. I mean, Hollywood has been used as propaganda going at least as far back as World War II. And so it begins with this, with accurate information, and then it quickly goes south. And there's basically four sources in the documentary. There's two Hollywood stuntmen. There's Kevin Shipp, who is supposedly a, quote, former CIA operative. And then there's a journalist named Liz Cronkin, who concocted the whole Pizzagate scenario, which is kind of like the embryonic QAnon. What's fascinating about it is at one point you see this pattern, taking a previous conspiracy theory that was essentially anti-fascist at its core and then flipping it. So back in the 1970s, Mae Russell, who was very left-leaning conspiracy theorist, political researcher, she was referred to as the queen of conspiracies. She began talking about what she called Operation Chaos, which was a CIA-driven plot to assassinate anti-establishment rock stars like Jim Morrison and Janis Joplin. Later on, Alex Constantine wrote a whole book about this very scenario. So in Out of the Shadows, Kevin Shipp, the supposed former CIA operative, takes Russell's theory and flips it.
The funny part, you know, former CIA operative. Yeah, sure.
Well, right. I don't know if you're ever a former CIA operative. No,
former mafia. Yeah, sure.
Right, exactly. So in Shipp's version, in Out of the Shadows, the rock stars aren't the victims, they're the perpetrators. So he implies that Jim Morrison and Frank Zappa were both MKUltra mind control drones because their fathers were in the military. So therefore, the Doors and the Mothers of Invention were part of like a CIA plot to convince kids to drop out and take LSD, which is a variation of what Lyndon LaRouche, the very right-leaning Lyndon LaRouche was saying for years, as if American teenagers, you know, need anyone's help to take drugs. You know, I don't, in my experience, American teenagers do not need outside influence to get them to take drugs.
Nowhere else do kids need any help there.
So the pattern throughout QAnon is to take a pre-existing conspiracy theory that's speaking out against fascism and martial law and flip it. So now it's for fascism and martial law. And in fact, I listened to a lot of QAnon podcasts leading up to January 6th. And January 6th is the logical outcome of everything that Q had been promoting. And when I first started publishing these articles about QAnon in Salon, I was told by a lot of people, you know, you're wasting your time. You're just legitimizing QAnon by even mentioning it. You should just ignore it.
Yeah, yeah. And that is, I think, one of the problems. And yeah, I think that's, you know, if you just stop talking about something, then it just grows and grows and grows. And I mean, there are a couple of things, of course, that are on the edge, and I think they use those things purposefully. So, for example, this whole pizza thing where the FBI actually says, yeah, that was a code word, so I don't know if that is accurate, but I guess it is, for, you know, child molesters and so on. But then there's also, for example, you quote from those emails that John Podesta apparently said, I'm going to have pizza for an hour. And, you know, the funny thing is when I read that, I was like, what a strange way to say that. But you don't think that is a strange way to say that?
Or did I just fall
into the trap? I don't know. But I also thought it's a strange way to say that. I mean, we would say, yeah, I'll take an hour off and have some pizza or something like that. But having pizza for an hour, like what you do, you order a big pizza and you eat it. And when the hour is over, you stop. You know, I don't know. But I'm not a native English speaker. So I don't know. Is that a...
Well, every labor union in America considers an hour to be the appropriate amount of time in which to eat lunch.
So it's not about the 1 hour. It's about saying I'll have pizza for 1 hour. You know what I mean? I mean, and you even quote some guys who say, yeah, you could have a massage or a service for 1 hour, but eating pizza for 1 hour, I have to agree in this case, that sounds strange. As I said, I'm not a native English speaker, so I don't know. Maybe that's just the way you say it. But
I would say my main analysis of that aspect of the documentary, because again, the documentary, the way it's structured is you start out with accurate information about real conspiracies like MK Ultra, which actually happened. You know, I mean, mental patients, prisoners, children were experimented on. There was a whole committee that the Clinton administration put together in the early 90s investigating the illegal, unconstitutional radiation experiments that were done on children, mental patients, prisoners, marginalized people. And a lot of those experiments overlapped with the MKUltra scientists. Same scientists doing those radiation experiments were the same ones doing the MKUltra mind control experiments. And you can, if you go to YouTube and look up, you know, radiation committee, you know, Clinton, you'll see that this was talked about. You know, it's not a theory. So all that stuff is actually accurate. But then it slowly leads you off into Wonderland,
yeah.
Where by the end you're talking about the Pizzagate scenario.
Yeah.
And they begin, you would think they would begin with their best evidence, because like the last half hour of the documentary is entirely focused on Pizzagate. And they start out by saying, well, John Podesta, in these emails, they claim that every time the word pizza is used, it's a code word for pedophilia, for having sex with children. And they claim that a triangle is the universal symbol used by that the FBI says that this is actually a symbol used by pedophiles. I have no idea if that's even true. But
I mean, neither. I don't know. But if it's true, then I don't. But just so you don't think that it's a strange way of saying it, having pizza for an hour.
I'd like to see how
you see that sentence, because it kind of struck me odd. That's all. I mean,
I'm more focused on the false dichotomy aspect of it, because they then go on to say, well, if they're not eating pizza for an hour, the only possible alternative is that they're having sex with young boys. You know, it's either A, they're having pizza, or B, they're having sex with young boys.
But But what I wanted to come to actually is, I think what you do is really great, because you really dig into that stuff. You try to find any evidence or any, parallels or just how this could be supported, those claims, and you dissect it in a brilliant way. But very often those theories, they come out, and yeah, they're most probably bullshit, but some aspects of it might be true, as is the case for Out of the Shadows. So there are some aspects in it, yeah, they're not bullshit. But then what happens is that, first of all, also the stuff that is actually real gets, so today, thrown out of the window, so to say, because, you know, it appears in this documentary and 80 or 90% is bullshit, so this must be bullshit too. So that's problem number one. And those people that fall into this trap, they will always say, yeah, but, you know, that part was true. So how, you know, and that's how that disinformation game, of course, works. So you hold out the carrot and then you pull them in and tell them all kind of stuff that you actually want to tell them. But if you don't, if then this is not taken seriously by you know, anyone, then those people who fall for it, you know, they just get into it deeper and deeper. And then suddenly you have a situation as we have now, and it's getting worse every day, where you have two groups, and, okay, call them Democrats and Republicans, or left and right, or blue and green, or whatever, who completely shut down communication because the other side is completely stupid, evil, whatever, and we were not going to talk to them. But then, and just in the last show, I did something about emotional intelligence, which is, I think, is a very fascinating subject. And, you know, how to keep a dialogue and find a common ground, because that is really what's needed. But what is being done with stuff like QAnon is the divide just gets bigger and bigger and bigger. Until, I don't know where this is going to end. I don't know where this is going to end in the US, honestly, because it doesn't look good. I mean, I don't want to say the CW word, but, you know, looks like sometimes.
Well, I think that in fact you've hit on the exact purpose of QAnon, which is to make all of this stuff that is legitimate to make it look ridiculous. There's a fascinating. I saw a parallel recently with there's a documentary that recently premiered on Netflix called The Sons of Sam, which focuses on Maury Terry's. Maury Terry was an investigative journalist, and in the late 70s and 80s, he investigated the David Berkowitz, Son of Sam, serial killings, and connected it to a satanic cult that had links to the Manson family. He put in, I first read The Ultimate Evil when it, not long after it came out. I read it probably like in the early 90s. And you can, if you read the book, you can tell that Maury Terry put in hours and hours and days and years of sweat and footwork, you know, into researching this story. Then when the book came out, and you see this in the documentary that's on Netflix, in the third episode, I think, you see what happens when he goes on the into the media circus to promote the book. And so they'll put him on a show, Morton Downey Jr., one of those talk show hosts who had popular talk shows at the time, and they'd put him on with some, you know, far-right Christian evangelical who was talking about backward masking or, you know, satanic symbols in children's cartoons or secret satanic codes in comic books, in Disney films, etc. So Maury Terry's legitimate research would get overshadowed by the nonsense. And as I was watching it, I thought, well, the filmmakers must be aware of what an interesting parallel this is. Because there's one point in particular where you see a Maury Terry sitting there trying to talk about this serious research, and the host is holding up a plush, you know, Smurf doll, and then there's some weird Christian guy talking about how the Smurfs are a satanic symbol. And so everything that Maury Terry had put so much effort into trying to get all this information out was just completely turned into a ludicrous sideshow, because it got connected to this whole satanic panic that was going on in the 1980s. And you see very much a replay of the satanic panic now with QAnon.
Yeah.
And so to the extent that, just like how you just said, there were people who were listening to us thinking that we're pro QAnon, similarly, from the opposite perspective, when I published the first part of the Salon series, one of the comments in the comment section was from a woman saying, "How dare you make fun of John W. DeCamp?" John W. DeCamp was a state senator who wrote a book called The Franklin Cover-Up, which is probably one of the most disturbing books you'll ever read. and it's about a pedophilia ring that was operating out of Lincoln, Nebraska, and it was run by this guy named Lawrence E. King, who was a top Republican at the time. So the interesting thing is that John W. DeCamp's book, The Franklin Cover-Up, is about a pedophilia ring that was connected to the Republicans. But so that scenario then gets flipped. Again, it's another example of a previous conspiracy theory getting flipped and then blamed entirely on the Democrats instead. But The Franklin Cover-Up was a very serious book DeCamp was claiming that this pedophilia ring overlapped with Iran-Contra and money laundering and all the stuff that was going on with Oliver North and the Reagan White House, and in the subsequent Bush White House. In the article, I mentioned this. I mentioned that John W. DeCamp's Franklin cover-up is also another clear precedent for the QAnon narrative. And this person writes a comment saying, "How dare you make fun of John W. DeCamp? He was a real researcher, and he put in hours of... At no point in the article do I ever say anything negative about John W. DeCamp. I wouldn't do that because I actually think there's some valid information in that book. I don't agree with everything, every conclusion he comes to, but I think that there is a core of seriousness there. And yet somehow she read the article and assumed I was making fun of John W. DeCamp.
Oh boy. Yeah. Yeah. That's really disturbing, because then you know how those things travel, you know? And I mean, cryptoscatology, it's just full of, I mean, absolutely fascinating conspiracy details. And just to name one here is, and that really struck me like, wow, Al Gore studied NLP under John Alexander. And that is such an, I mean, when I read that, it's like, wow, because there is a connection between the abduction phenomenon and climate change in a funny way. Iloban von Ludwiger, my next guest, by the way, he points that out in his latest EGAP book that he brought out. It's kind of a regular, or well, not a regular, but a publication that comes out every half a year or something like that of his investigative group, of his research group into phenomenon of UFOs, etc. And I mean, abductees, they narrate or they talk about being on this UFO, being shown films of how the Earth is being destroyed and really emotionally aroused and really kind of brainwashed. I mean, I it looks like, and you know, I'm absolutely not against saving the planet. Oh my God, yeah, there's a lot going wrong and we need to do it. But those people, those experiences they make, they almost look like being climate change brainwashed, or you know what I mean, being really brought into this mindset, and this is just a weird connection, and this is one of those connections that pop out in your book that just made me go, wow. That fits so well, but probably just coincidence.
Well, it's interesting what you're saying, because it just occurred to me that one could argue that the early UFO contactees were among the earliest ecological,
yes. Yes.
green movements. You know, I mean, how many of the contactees said yes? You know, they came and they told us, you know, you stop destroying your planet.
Yeah.
That is a motif in the early contactee literature, certainly.
And still today it is, or in the 90s it used to be, and also the early noughties, it used to be a motif that comes out again and again. And as I said, Iloban von Ludwig also points out this connection, which I don't know. I mean, it might be totally legit. It might be something completely different. I mean,
yeah, I think that in fact, I think was a plank in the platform of Gabriel Green. I don't know if you know who that is, but Gabriel Green was one of the earliest among those early contactees, and he actually ran on a third party independent ticket for president on a UFO ticket. He was third party presidential candidate in the, I think, early 60s or maybe mid 60s, running for president on a UFO ticket. And Gabriel Green used to be a staple at the Giant Rock conferences that they would have there in Giant Rock. In fact, Gabriel Green, when he died, which was, I think, in 2001, his family, the relatives that survived him, were not into UFOs at all. And I guess they thought all that stuff was nonsense. So they were just going to get rid of his massive archives of files and letters and books. And so my friend, Walter Boart, who is since deceased, he died in December of 2007 of cancer. Walter Boart wrote Operation Mind Control, which was the very first, really the first major serious book about MKUltra, which came out in 1978. And I had met Boart in the late 90s, around about 1999, maybe. And so Boart moved out to Santa Monica, and he had heard about that Gabriel Green had died and that his family was planning on getting rid of all of his stuff. So he calls me and he goes, we're going to Gabriel Green's storage unit. You want to come with me and help clear it out? We got to get to it before the family gets to it. So I go, okay. So I get into his van, and me and Walter drive it was like in the middle of the desert near a Joshua tree. And we're going through all of Gabriel Green's stuff. And amongst his, there's all these old, like, you know, vote for Gabriel Green, bumper stickers, you know, vote Gabriel Green for president, bumper stickers that said things like, the UFOs exist, the Air Force doesn't, all these like weird presidential
That's great.
Slogans.
UFOs exist, the Air Force doesn't. Okay.
And there was all these stacks and stacks of these things. I have some of them. I have some of the bumper stickers to this day. Amongst the stuff, as we were going through all the stuff and putting it in Walter's van, was a letter from Senator Robert Kennedy to either Gabriel Green or Gray Barker. I can't remember at this point who it was addressed to, but the date of the letter was not long before Robert Kennedy's assassination. And they had either Gabriel Green or Gray Barker had written to Robert Kennedy about what are your views on UFOs. And he had written back this letter saying, I actually take UFOs very seriously. I think it represents a real phenomenon. It was this amazing letter. It was about, you know, two paragraphs long. And I wish I had it. It was amongst Walter's effects. So I don't know what happened to it. I mean, Walter had it, you know. But it was just the whole storage space was just filled with all this amazing stuff. And it took us all day to get all this stuff into the back of Walter's van. And by this point, the sun was setting, and Walter, we went somewhere to eat. And then Walter said, you know what? I'm really tired. I don't know if we can drive back. Why don't we just camp out in Joshua Tree for the night? Which I was ill-equipped for. I was not wearing warm clothing at all. And it gets just freezing cold out in Joshua Tree. So we're now camping in Joshua Tree, and off in the distance is the 29 Palms military base. You can actually see the lights of the base off in the distance. And we had to pull out all of the stuff. Well, not all of it, but a bunch of the boxes, so we'd have room to lay down in the back of the van. As we're doing this, and it's now nighttime, and Walter is smoking a cigar, and off in the distance we see this, what at first I think is a star over the 29 Palms military base. And you know how if you look at a star long enough, even if it's stationary, it begins to seem as if maybe it's moving slightly back and forth. So at first I thought that's what was going on, thought it was some sort of optical illusion. And then Walter, as he's smoking the cigar, he says, is that moving? You know, and then I'm looking at it, and I say, well, I think it's just a star. But then it slowly began to move more dramatically until finally it was just zipping back and forth. And it was doing all this crazy maneuvers suddenly. and we sat there and watched it. And, you know, usually when I hear about UFO sightings, they're usually over in a second. This thing just kept doing it like for so long that eventually Walter and I were like, we're tired. We just have to go. We just have to go to sleep. We just left it. It was like, okay, you just keep doing your little whatever the hell you're doing above the military base. We got to go to sleep, you know. So we went to the back of the van, and I don't know what it did after that. Maybe it landed like 5 feet away from us.
Of course, 5 seconds after you started watching it, just
yeah. And it was interesting. It was like right over the military base. So I assume that that wasn't a coincidence. I assume that this was some sort of, you know, military vehicle. If so, it was defying all of the known laws of physics, which is as amazing as if it was an extraterrestrial object. So,
yeah, sounds like the ping pong UFO or something like that. One of those recent releases. Wasn't there something like the ping pong UFO that just made those really erratic movements?
Yes, absolutely. And in fact, you know, in regards to Gabriel Green, which, by the way, we later found out that half of his archives had already been sold to this bookstore in town. But fortunately, Walter knew someone else who was able to get there and buy Gabriel Green's sort of massive UFO library, and they donated it to a library up in Oregon, which is kind of like this new age library, and I can't remember the name of it now. But apparently, then when Walter died, a lot of the stuff that Walter had then also went to this library up in Oregon. I think it's called the Metaphysical Library, something like that. And so perhaps the Rock Candy letter is somewhere in the archives of the Metaphysical Library in Oregon. But these figures like Gabriel Green, these sort of obscure figures from the 50s and the 60s who are often forgotten about. I saw a lecture by Linda Moulton Howe once where she sort of basically said that she thought that all of the contactees of the 50s were just not worth looking into at all, that they were all hoaxers and et cetera. And I actually have to disagree with that. If you go back and read those old contactee books, they're absolutely fascinating. And particularly in regards to the way you began the show, if you go back and read Donald Kehoe's books, for example, you see a lot of parallels with situations happening right now. Elizondo is kind of like a modern Donald Kehoe in the sense he has military contacts and is a UFO researcher. And Kehoe was in the same situation. But
I wouldn't put Louis Elizondo on the same level as Kehoe. I don't know.
I understand what you're saying. But just in the sense of a recurring pattern among UFO researchers where the government will, they will release information and then suppress it, and then release information and then suppress it. And I have a friend, Randy Kopang, who wrote a book called Camouflage Through Limited Disclosure, which is all about UFOs. And of course, the title comes from Philip Corso's book, The Day After Roswell, where he said that their attitude towards UFOs was camouflage through limited disclosure. So in other words, you release information in order to cover it up. It's almost like the purloined letter, the Edgar Allan Poe story, where the police are looking for this letter that's been stolen, and they're in the perpetrator's apartment, and they're looking for it, and they can't find it. So they hire this detective, Dupin, who comes in and immediately sees that the letter is, in fact, sitting on the mantelpiece in the letter holder. And the police have not been able to see it because it was hiding in plain sight. And Corso, without using the Edgar Allan Poe analogy, is essentially saying that with the phrase a camouflage through limited disclosure. And my friend Randy Kopang, he's working on a book right now where the thesis of the book is that essentially there is no UFO cover-up in the sense that information has been released from the very beginning. And if you go back and read those Kehoe books, you see examples of it over and over again, of them giving him information or releasing information and then pulling it back. And I think that we're in another one of those patterns at the moment. So William Faulkner once said that the past is never dead and buried. In fact, it's never even passed. For that reason, I think it's actually very valuable to go back and read those old UFO books from the 50s.
Oh, yeah. I totally think so. Yeah, because nothing really changed since then. It just...
Right.
I mean, I don't really see any substantial change. If anything, then things got, mellowed down over the years when they were cooked up for the third time or so on. And this is in itself a pattern that seems to repeat again and again. So if we have underground caves where people are being tortured by demons, or you have, or the UFO narratives that we get told again and again, that that might be something, you know, I with adrenochrome, for example. I obviously the adrenochrome thing comes from a science fiction story. I mean, I think that's pretty clear by to everyone, but well, not to everyone, of course, but to a lot of people. But maybe there is some other substance that, you know, that can be gained from a human body that could be used as a drug. And I'm just saying that is completely hypothetically. So I'm not saying that's the case. But I'm saying if there would be something like this, what better way to disguise this than to come up with some concocted story about adrenochrome that is bullshit? So if anyone then comes up with the real thing, they just go, oh, no, another adrenochrome story. Come on, go away. You know what I mean? It's a brilliant tactics. Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. There's, you know, I find that it's often better to reference pop culture than to reference, say, Noam Chomsky or, you know, Howard Zinn or Michael Parenti or any of these people. Nothing wrong with those people, but, you know, quoting academicians maybe doesn't, you know, go over so well, particularly in a venue like this. But in terms of pop culture, you know, there's the American sitcom called The Office, starring Steve Carell, and there's an episode where the main character, Michael Scott, played by Steve Carell, learns a salacious detail about one of the people who works for him, that this guy, Stanley, who works for him, is having an affair. He's cheating on his wife. And so Michael Scott, the main character, goes around and tells everybody this bit of gossip, and then later realizes that he's now potentially ruined Stanley's life. So he decides to try to rectify. He tries to correct himself. And he says at one point, how do you unsay something that has already been said? Well, you can't. But what you can do is go around and spread a lot of other lies to try to obscure the real one.
So
he then goes around the office and spreads a lot of fallacious gossip in order to obscure the one true rumor. And I think that sort of summarizes QAnon. It's interesting that Q pops up in October, November 2017. And you may recall, you know, I think the Jeffrey Epstein story, there was a woman who gave a press conference in 2016 who remained anonymous. And she was in the process of suing Donald Trump because she claimed that Trump had raped her when she was 13 in 1994 at Jeffrey Epstein's house. She was going to sue Donald Trump, and she was going to have a press conference, and then suddenly she pulled back on it. And her lawyer said she's decided not to move forward with the case. But I wonder if stuff like that, you know, Donald Trump was on page 85 of Jeffrey Epstein's little black book. You know, the QAnon narrative keeps, you know, focusing on the fact that the Clintons were in Jeffrey Epstein's little black book, always ignoring the fact that Donald Trump was also mentioned on page 85.
Yeah, but he just was there to find out what those evil guys are doing.
Well, right. I say in the article that if at some point if footage was released of Donald Trump having sexual congress with an underage female, then Jeffrey Epstein was there recording it all on a video camera, they would say, "Oh, he had to do that in order to go
undercover and
investigate." Jeffrey Epstein, you know, it's absolutely insane. No matter what you say, no matter what happens, they will try to just twist it back into their QAnon narrative. I mean, I even saw someone was going around interviewing people. It was at a Trump rally. And they said, what do you think about Trump saying that, you know, if he mowed a bunch of people down with a gun on Madison Avenue, people would still vote for him.
Yeah.
And the woman, the Trump supporter, said, oh, he never said that.
Yeah, Jordan Clapper, Jordan Clapper on some Trump convention?
Trump actually said at a rally. It seems like an off the cuff statement. Donald Trump said, "Listen, it doesn't matter what I do. I can mow you know, a dozen people down with a machine gun on Madison Avenue, people would still vote for me. And he actually did say that. And but then they were, when they were repeating this to the Trump supporter, they were, oh, that's a deep fake. You know, that's just fake news. He never said that. And in terms of the, so it's interesting that all the stuff with Ben comes out and then the QAnon narrative is created, almost as if it's purposely created to distance Trump from Epstein. And what's funny is they'll take something, QAnon will take something that is true, and then they will try to connect it to these other things that are really are not connected. There's a section in the article that's titled Epstein plus Trump minus Trump equals Hillary. We've seen numerous interviews with Epstein's victims, and not one of them ever says, oh yes, Epstein, he came out wearing his crimson cowl. You know, he had 13 disciples and then they performed a blood sacrifice to an obsidian statue of Baphomet on Epstein Island. No, you know, all we've heard is pretty like standard casebook narcissistic predatory behavior on Epstein's part. There's nothing esoteric about it. You know, it's bad enough. The Jeffrey Epstein story is bad enough. You don't need to lay on to it the satanic Illuminati underground cavern aspect to it. So I clearly, you know, Epstein, I think it's like 98% chance that he did not kill himself. Yeah, you know, no. I think you'd have to be pretty naive to think that he actually killed himself. Yeah. In fact, there was an article in, I think it was the New York Times. I linked to it on my blog at one point. There was a guy who had actually served time in the same cell block that Epstein was in. And that guy said, no way. There's absolutely no way you could kill yourself on that cell block. It's constantly monitored. There's no way you couldn't hang yourself. He went through, you know, point by point about how there's no way you could kill yourself. Supposedly that something was wrong with the camera that night. The two security guards were both asleep. You know, so I think it's clear that Epstein was clearly blackmailing these very powerful people, probably on behalf of the Foreign Intelligence Agency, in order to manipulate policy. And since Trump's name is in his little black book, I can only assume that Trump was one of those people being blackmailed. I mean, I think that that's, you know,
yeah, and a lot of powerful people were very relieved once Epstein was gone. So yeah, he killed himself for sure. Who believes that? Well, of course, I can't exclude that he really killed himself. Could be. I don't know. But there are a lot of reasons.
It's for.
Yeah. So just coming back to cryptoscatology, I mean, this book is just anyone who is interested in conspiracy as a subject, and also in real examples and of real conspiracies and examples of fake conspiracies and how that all plays together, I can only absolutely recommend this. And just another interesting detail that you dug up, I mean, Bush and Kerry, who ran in the presidential election of 2008, or was it 2008, where they ran against each other, both being, no, not eight, four, where two Skull and Bones members ran against each other. I mean, what are the odds? But it gets even better. Both of them are related to Vlad the Impaler. And this guy is the one that the whole Dracula story comes from, isn't it?
Well, you know, it's interesting. See, this is another aspect of the.
But they are really related to him, to Drac. And by the way, I think that the whole Dracula, originally it should have played in Styria or in Graz even or something like that. And then he moved it to this Vlad the Impaler guy. A strange story on itself, but I mean, how strange is that? I mean, maybe it means nothing, but then again, yeah, it's just weird.
The Skull and Bones aspect of it is one of those aspects that the, you know, because obviously the QAnon narrative focuses a lot on secret societies, and that's something I go into in cryptoscatology. You know, there are there are secret societies, Skull and Bones being one of them, the Yale secret society that George Bush was a member of. Supposedly, you know, they stole Geronimo's skull and they dug up Geronimo's skull and they supposedly have Geronimo's skull in the lodge there on Yale. And the Native Americans have been trying to sue him, sue the Yale for years, trying to get the skull back. Apparently, it was part of like some initiation that they had to go steal Geronimo's skull, and they use it in their rituals. But there's a wonderful book about the Skull and Bones called America's Secret Establishment by Anthony Sutton, S-U-T-T-O-N, Anthony Sutton. And that book, in fact, was republished by Trinday, which published Cryptoscatology. It was one of the reasons I approached Trinday to publish Cryptoscatology, because I was really impressed by how they had represented this important book, America's Secret Establishment. And that's one of the books I use in the fifth category that I mentioned earlier, how there were these five categories: insanity, disinformation, misinformation, satire, and legitimate research. And so I mentioned Anthony Sutton's America's Secret Establishment as an example of one of the works of legitimate research. And in fact, you know, in terms of UFOs, I mentioned Above Top Secret by Timothy Good. There's a book called The Assassination of Robert Kennedy by John Christian and William Turner, which was one of the early books that turned me on onto all of this. Alan Cantwell, who recently passed away back in January of this year, Dr. Alan Cantwell wrote a book called AIDS and the Doctors of Death, which went into the whole idea of AIDS being a biowarfare weapon. And that there's actually a lot of interesting research in that regard. Leonard Horowitz's book, Emerging Viruses, touches on that as well. And also one of the most peculiar John F. Kennedy assassination books is Ed Haslam's Mary Fairy and the Monkey Virus, which overlaps with the AIDS as biowarfare weapon and the Kennedy assassination and ties them both together in the most peculiar way.
I have a quote. I had one on my show. Credo Mutua also thought that this was a deliberate attack, so to say. So a lot of people think that, yeah.
Yeah, Haslam's book. Haslam's book was recently republished under the title Dr. Mary's Monkey. Those are all examples that I use in the book of legitimate research, you know, which they sound as nutty. You know, I suppose to some people they might sound as crazy as the QAnon stuff. And in fact, someone might say, well, hey, didn't you write a book called Camellio about a bunch of crazy stuff? I mean, well, how does that different from QAnon? But actually, I would say that if you read Camellio, which is all about unconstitutional, illegal surveillance and harassment of U.S. citizens and, in fact, citizens all around the globe, that research in Camellio actually overlaps. It actually overlaps with the QAnon narrative in the sense that the QAnon narrative is an extension of the gang stalking program that I'm talking about in Camellio, in the sense that in Camellio, I talk about my friend Damien. In the book, I call him Dion because I changed all the names unless they were public figures. Damien ran afoul of the NCIS, the Naval Criminal Investigative Services, back in 2003 because he was kind of living in a party house in Pacific Beach, and he let this guy stay there, just crash on his couch. And it was this kid named Lee/Doyle. We're not quite sure what his real name was, but Lee/Doyle had gone AWOL from Camp Pendleton, a Marine base in San Diego. And Damien, my friend, did not know that this kid had gone AWOL from Camp Pendleton. But one night, Damien was having a party at his apartment in Pacific Beach in San Diego. And this kid who had gone AWOL suddenly whips out this laptop computer and opens it. And this DOD logo appears on the screen. And my friend Damien was like, whoa, wait a minute. Get that stuff and get the hell out of here. Because he suddenly realizes that this thing has been stolen. And he wants nothing to do with it. And this kid goes, oh, don't worry. They can't track this stuff. Well, what had happened was when he had gone AWOL from Camp Pendleton, he'd stolen this DOD laptop computer. He'd stolen a 9mm gun taken off the body of a dead Iraqi general. He'd taken 2 dozen pairs of high-tech night vision goggles and also an entire truck. And this happened 2 years after 9/11. And a few minutes after he says, oh, don't worry, they can't track this stuff. There's a knock at the door. Damien goes and he opens the door. And there's a woman there who identifies herself as Special Agent Lita Johnson, which isn't her real name. And there's two like men in black kind of looking goons behind her. And she says, we'd like to search your apartment. And Damien, whose father was a narcotics cop, he knew his rights very well. And he said, not without a warrant, you're not going to search the apartment. And so she said, well, we'll be right back then. She leaves. Damien closes the door. He immediately turns to everyone at the party and says, okay, grab your drugs and get out the back. You know, the heat's here. And instead of doing that, they throw their drugs onto his living room carpet and then rush out the back. And the cops come. So the San Diego Police Department comes and the NCIS. And Damien described it as if they were kind of bumping into each other in a kind of Keystone Cop kind of way. And they were not interested in the drugs on his carpet at all. They were fixated for some reason on these night vision goggles. They really wanted these night vision goggles back. And supposedly, according to Damien, none of them were in the apartment, or maybe some of them were, but not all of them, which he wasn't aware of this. The guy who had gone AWOL had brought some of them into the apartment, apparently. So they arrest Damien, and they arrest this guy, Lee/Doyle. He said his name was Lee, but later on, Damien was told that his real name was Doyle. And so Damien is arrested, and he's given the Abu Ghraib treatment for about a week in the San Diego jail. And they think that Damien's involved in some sort of international smuggling ring, smuggling these night vision goggles and other military equipment to foreign terrorists, perhaps. And Damien just keeps saying, listen, I have no idea about any of this. I have no idea. You know, I just met this guy like 2 days ago, which they didn't believe. And Damien had been in and out of prison his whole life. So he was not likely to snitch on anyone. I mean, even if he could have given them information that they wanted, he probably wouldn't have done it. But they just thought that he was purposely messing with them, I guess. And after about a week of this, they finally let Damien go. And he had been gone for a whole week. This was July of 2003. I remember this because this is the same week that I was initiated into the third degree of Freemasonry. And I mentioned that because it's important later on. And so when I went through the third degree, I went home and I called Damien to tell him, you know, that I had not been sacrificed to Baphomet. And he wasn't there. He wasn't home. And so I thought, well, okay, you know, I left a message. Usually he'd get back to me within like 24 hours. Well, he doesn't call. Whole week goes by, and I wonder, like, what the hell happened to him? A week later, he calls me, and he says, oh, you know, I just got out of jail. And he tells me the whole story that I've just told you. And we both think, well, that's weird. Obviously, that's the end of it. They probably realize that you didn't really know anything, and there it's going to end.
And for everybody listening, we have a picture page prepared today again. And so on images 6 and 7, you see Damien standing in front his black van that I'm sure you'll get to shortly. And then there are also some other pictures from Damien on the picture page. So please go on.
Yeah, so Damien, he's back at home, and he thinks the whole thing is over. But then a few days later, he calls me to tell me that there's all these people following him all around Pacific Beach. And
that's where it really gets weird. And that's why I think it's important to see that Damien is a real guy. So this really happened. It's not a fictional book. That just apparently really happened, which is absolutely astonishing.
Yes, he claims that that he's being followed, and not just followed by like one or two people, like a whole parade of military-looking jarhead guys are following him into the local 7-Eleven. You know, he'd go out, they'd follow him out. He'd go to the Mexican restaurant down the street, sit down. They'd all sit at tables around him. He'd go home. They would shine halogen lights through his windows at 3 a.m. They'd park right outside his a bedroom window and blare music on their car radios really loud. And he's telling me all this, and I'm thinking, at first my thought was, well, is he suffering from like meth-induced paranoia? Like what is going on here? He didn't seem any, you know, different than I, you know, I'd known him since I met him on my 16th birthday. So I'd known him a long time, and I was used to sort of the normal Damien craziness. And then this was different. But he was acting pretty much normal, except for this one aspect of telling me he's being followed. And so I said, okay, well, look, why don't you take photographs of these cars or photograph the license plates, write them down, send me a list of the license plates. So he sends me some photographs. He sends me a list of these license plates of these cars that he says are following him around. And I happen to know someone who worked at the DMV in up in Washington, Washington State. So I sent him the list of license plate numbers, and the guy calls me back and says, none of them officially exist, which I thought was very strange because, of course, even if Damien was being paranoid and just thought that these cars owned by people who lived in the neighborhood were following him, they would come up as real cars and real people who live in San Diego. But they came up as officially non-existent. And to me, that was the first indication that maybe he wasn't suffering from meth-induced paranoia, that maybe this was actually happening, because the only reason they wouldn't officially exist is if they were government vehicles. So he starts telling me that he's getting bombarded with what I can only describe as hallucinations, in the sense that he would look out his window and the scenery that was normally there was no longer there. Instead of it being a parking lot and a Vons, now it was like three moons in the sky, and it looked like a Boris Vallejo painting.
Yeah, and that is so that is so strange. How would they even do that? I have no idea.
He would open the door, and it was just, you know, the normal everyday scenery.
Yes.
But then he would go inside and then look out the window, and it was like he was on, you know, Barsoom or Hegarice Burroughs' planet. Keep in mind, at this time, he was surrounded by corporations like SAIC, Science Applications International Corporation, and ATC, American Technology Corporation. And as you'll discover later on, SAIC is actually a core company in manufacturing these, quote, non-lethal weapons, which John Alexander was the father of course, non-lethal weapons that will kill you, of course. He then tells me that he calls and he says that his apartment is growing or shrinking, kind of like, in other words, and it's not just him seeing this. Other people would come over and say, is your apartment getting bigger? And you would go on the inside and it would look larger on the inside than it was from the outside. Or conversely, it would look smaller on the inside than it looked from the outside.
How would you do that? I mean, this reminds me of a you know, Magical Mystery Tour from the Beatles, where they crawl into this tent and then in the inside it's a huge tent. I mean, okay, yeah. But how would they do that?
It reminded me of the TARDIS in Doctor Who. You know, he has the blue telephone box and he goes in, it's larger on the inside than it is on the outside. Well, there actually is technology that can create the illusion of that, which we'll discover in a little bit. But all kinds of things were happening where one day he was in his kitchen and there were these two guys, two jarhead looking dudes right outside his window, and they were talking about him as if he wasn't there. And so he's in the kitchen and he starts grabbing various ingredients from the cabinets, the kitchen cabinets. He's grabbing like spaghetti and pasta and peanut butter and flour and talcum powder and merging it in Jell-O, and he merges it all together in this bowl. And then he opens the window, and then he runs outside and he tosses this slop over the fence, and it hits the two jarheads in the head, and they run off. They run off into the Vaughn's parking lot with all this glop on their head. And oddly enough, that led to one of the few moments that Lisa Johnson actually admitted that this surveillance was happening. What would happen was things like that would happen. Then, and there's all these cars surrounding his apartment. Suddenly, one day they all back out, and then a car comes in, and it's Special Agent Lita Johnson. And she walks up with her two goons, knocks on the door, and says, "So have you changed your mind, Damien? Have you decided to cooperate and give us the information that we want? You know, we really want to know where these night vision goggles are." And Damien's like, "I don't have a clue as to where these things are, because as I told you, I just met this guy like 3 days before you arrested him. I have no idea where this stuff is." "Oh, okay. Well, here's my card. If you change your mind, then let us know." Then she'd get in the car, car would back out, and then all the other cars would come back in, and the whole thing would start all over again. And so then it gets to the point where, by the way, just to finish the thing about the food fight, later on he actually met with Lita Johnson at a bagel shop on Garnet Avenue in Pacific Beach, trying to convince her, you know, that he didn't know anything. And he at one point he said to her, "Listen, I want this all to end. I don't want to have any more food fights with the feds." And she laughed, and she said, "Yes, that made us all laugh." So that was like the only moment where she actually kind of like broke script and actually admitted that they were watching him. But things got super weird when he calls me to tell me that there were invisible people in his house who were interacting with him, pushing him over, was spying on him. And he claimed that he was in the bathroom one day, and he knew, kind of sensed, that there were these people there in the apartment, even though he could not see them. And one day he was in the bathroom, and he opened the medicine cabinet, and the mirror on the medicine cabinet was in motion, he could see vaguely the outline of these little people in these like skin-tight suits behind him. And I thought, that's interesting. And then because if there was some sort of like light bending technology being used here, that kind of made some kind of cockeyed sense to me. Like, okay, as the mirror was in motion, he was able to see them just for that half a second. And of course, Damien's not a physicist or anything, so it seemed like a genuine detail to me. And he also mentioned that sometimes he would see them as little dots in the air, little auras, almost like what some people see when they have an intense migraine headache. They'll see these auras in the air. And he would see that, but just briefly, as an outline of these little people. And around that same time.
Yeah, that's of course also where the connection to Chris Marx comes in. So you were on the show, UFO Classified, with Erica Lukes. And that's also when the first and only interview I heard from you, because I usually don't listen to interviews of people I'm going to interview, but... And that kind of got me hooked on Camellio. So that's the book we're just talking right now. And by the way, Cryptoscatology and Camellio are linked up below the show for anyone who is interested. And these are two hell of a books. And yes, and obviously Chris Marx had quite similar experiences, wouldn't you say?
Oh, very much so. I talked to Chris for well over 2 hours, both him and Erica. And he had a similar, he read Camellio, he called me and he said, "This, everything that's Damien experiences, I experience." Every single thing. And he had an experience where he was on the ranch, the Skinwalker Ranch, which, you know, when I was on Coast to Coast, and George Knapp interviewed me, and I compared notes with him about his book on the Skinwalker Ranch, because there's a lot of details that overlap. Chris Marx, when he was there working on the ranch, he saw this old man turn into a wolf. But he got the sense that what he saw was not actually what was there. You know, it almost like in the same way that, you know, Damien would look out the window and see the three moons in the sky. Again, keep in mind, within walking distance of Damien's apartment at Pacific Beach was SAIC and these corporations that specialized in making non-lethal weapons, acoustic bullets. There was a situation with acoustic bullets. I was talking to Damien on the phone, and suddenly I hear everything crashing around him. Damien, who's not easily spooked, goes under the table, he's on the phone with me, and he's describing to me how all the tchotchkes on the shelf are just exploding, as if they're getting hit by invisible projectiles.
Absolutely amazing. Damien, absolutely amazing.
And it was only later on that I found out that the American Technology Corporation, which was there at that time, they specialize in creating acoustic bullets made of sound. And it was also around the same time that Damien saw that he was in bed in the bedroom, and a shadow appeared on the wall of a hand with a gun in it, and it would tip down and point at his head and then tip up again. And then he saw this black amorphous energy that crawled across the carpet. He had a leather jacket laying on the carpet. The black amorphous energy crawled across the carpet, filled up the leather jacket, and then the leather jacket crawled across the floor. I mentioned this to Melinda Leslie, who's an alien abductee, and she immediately told me, "Oh, I've had that same experience."
Isn't that, you know, and that's where it really, really gets interesting. First of all, I mean, again, I have no idea how they would even do that, you know? And I would even say, well, maybe he was harassed by aliens. That's a very far, far possibility. I don't think that's the case, but, you know. But
you know, Damien told me at one point, he said, if I hadn't had the experience with Lita Johnson and the NCIS and being interrogated, I would have thought that I was dealing with aliens.
Yeah. And I mean that really sends shivers down or up or whatever my spine, because for years and decades we read all those stories about alien abduction, stuff like that. But then you say there are those stories about invisible entities since the 30s. And I mean, we don't know what kind of technology that is. We don't know how long it has been existing. It could be some physical effect that can be engineered but not really modeled. But who cares if it works, you know? So it could be technology that has been around for a long time. And not only this kind of technology, also other technologies for anti-gravity or whatever, however you want to call that. But, you know, that kind of turns the world around, you know, because suddenly, okay, there is a really good alternative explanation for all those weird things that happens to people.
Well, skipping ahead in the story a little bit, later on, when Damien had left Pacific Beach in San Diego, he was trying to find on the internet anything that looked like what he had seen. And he found this guy named Professor Tashi, who was a Japanese inventor who created this invisibility cloak, but it didn't look like what he had seen, because the invisibility cloak only cloaks things from one angle. And finally, he came upon the site, Chameleo.net, and which was run by a guy named Richard Schoenger. Now, Damien said, "You should look at this. It's kind of interesting." So I look at it, and I was fascinated by the fact that Richard Schoenger, he had a top secret clearance. He had this thing he called Project Chameleo, which was optical camouflage, in other words, invisibility. And he was identified himself as a 33rd degree Freemason in the Scottish Rite at Long Beach. Well, I'm a 32nd degree Freemason in that same Scottish Rite in Long Beach. And I thought, this is weird. I must have met this guy, but I don't remember meeting him. So I contact Richard. And I said, "Hey, you know, I'm a writer. I've interviewed all kinds of people. I've done interviews for New Dawn magazine, and I'm really fascinated in your technology. Do you mind if I interview you?" And I think because I was a fellow Freemason, he said yes. And I said, "I'm in your lodge." He goes, "Well, come down this Saturday. We'll, after the ritual, we'll go and have lunch." So I told Damien, hey, I'm supposed to meet with this guy. Damien drives all the way down in his black van, drives all the way down from Winona, Kansas, where he was living at the time. And we met with Richard.
And there are pictures of this meeting also on the picture page. So it's called Bilder zur Sendung. Of course, it's in German, and the link. And there you can see image 1, 2, 3. In the first one, you can see Robert Guffey and Richard Schoengert. And then two further pictures of Richard.
Yeah, and I had no idea. You know, I really thought that the chances of this actually tying into what Damien had undergone was low. But we, after lunch, we took Richard back to my office on campus. We sat down, and I started interviewing him. And without me even bringing anything up, he suddenly mentions all the stuff about his technology that ties in exactly with stuff that has already, that has happened to Damien. He mentions that, oh, well, with this technology, you can make a room look, you know, bigger on the inside than it is on the outside. You can make it look smaller. You can make people think that a tree is actually an elephant or vice versa. He said that you can use this technology for psychological warfare purposes. He said, in fact, that's in the original patent. He mentions that he had been visited by SAIC and by the Navy 10 years earlier, and that they had seemed interested in his technology, and he had taken both representatives of SAIC and the Navy to his lab that he shares with Dr. Lev Berger, his partner, who is an eminent physicist, lives in Hemet, California, which is the middle of nowhere. He had taken SAIC and the representatives from the Navy out to his lab to show them what their whole technology was like. And they expressed great interest. He thought, oh, they're going to fund this. We can work together to create this. They just disappeared. They just ghosted him. So he began to think that they were vacuum cleaners. They vacuumed up the information, or they wanted to see how far along he was as opposed to whatever it is they were doing. And so he mentions out of the blue that he's actually planning on suing the military because he feels that his technology was stolen. And so at one point during the interview, after he says all of this and other stuff, the whole interview is in the book, I turned to Damien. I said, Damien, why don't you tell Richard your story? And Richard at first looked a little wary, like, what's this? As if maybe he was about to get sandbagged or something. But Damien tells him the whole story. And at first, Richard seemed really skeptical until Damien mentioned the thing about the mirror and seeing them in the mirror, it was in motion. And then particularly when he said that he would sometimes see them as little dots of light in the air, little auras. Richard, he leans forward and he goes, that's exactly what the technology looks like when it's not working properly. And he knew that that was something that Damien would not know. And he said that the thing with the mirror was because they're cloaking the suit, but not the mirror. So, and then, you know, when he learned that Damien was living essentially within walking distance of SAIC at the time, he really started to put, you know, two and two together. And so it's interesting. You can actually hear an interview with Richard that was done in 2019 by a guy named Jeff Brady, Brady, who hosts a show called In Other News on WBAI in New York. And he decided to contact Richard because he wanted to get Richard's side of the story, or maybe confirm that Richard actually existed. And he did. And so you can actually hear, if you just Google Jeff Brady and other news, Richard Schoengert, I'm sure you can find the interview. I have it linked up on my blog as well. So you can hear, you know, Richard's side of the story. And in fact, me and Richard did a whole presentation where we talked about this at the Masonic Lodge in Anaheim. And that was fascinating because the Masons in the audience, it was almost entirely Masons, some of them were in their 90s, and not one of them thought that what we were saying was incredible. You know, I mean, that you would think that they would say, oh, this is crazy. But after hearing what Richard said and hearing my side of it, they were just completely flabbergasted. But they didn't think it was impossible. So it was soon after this interview with Richard that I met up with Melinda Leslie, alien abductee, my lab researcher. And she had been doing a lecture at the Orange County MUFON. And afterwards, we were at dinner, and I kind of got sat next to her, and I was telling her the whole story. This is before Camellia even came out as a book. I was telling her about Damien's story, and within a half a second, I was maybe 5 minutes into the story, and she suddenly turns to me and she goes, "Oh, is this near SAIC?" SAIC is not something that's floating at the front of everyone's consciousness. But she immediately busted out with, "Oh, SAIC. I bet Damien lived near SAIC." And I said, "You were absolutely right. He did." Because she then told me that in the MyLab experiences that she had researched, and MyLab means military abduction. In other words, someone who's been abducted by aliens, but then later on, they're re-abducted by military people. And very often, these abductees say that the re-abduction by the military is often far more traumatic than what they experienced by the aliens or what appear to be aliens. Melinda said that of the hundreds of MyLab cases that she had researched, there was a strange connection with SAIC, with many of them. During the middle of the interview, Richard said, "Sometimes I wonder if they didn't steal it." And he said that before we told him about Damien's experiences. It was soon after that that you would think that Damien's reaction would be, relief. I'm not crazy. But actually, he sort of went into a kind of a spiraling depression after that, because I think the fact that he had met the guy who created the technology that was being used to harass him was like, oh my God, this is actually happening. I mean, I think that Damien was holding out hope that he was just crazy.
Yeah. And I can totally understand that. I mean, who wants to believe that people would use such methods? Because you tell stories where he has a conversation with someone, that one really stuck with me, in a supermarket or somewhere, and then he goes someplace else, and then two people come up beside him having the exact same conversation that he had with another guy. And I mean, this has nothing to do with electronic harassment, but you can see at what lengths they went to boil this guy. And then they were using apparently exotic technology that, I mean, who knows what it is capable of?
These are common techniques too. There's a woman you should look up, Gloria Naylor, a very famous, successful novelist. She wrote The Women of Brewster Place. Her last book that she published before she died was called 1996. Gloria Naylor is a huge star in the literary firmament, and yet her mainstream publisher would not publish 1996 because it's a story of her own harassment. Everything that Damien experienced, Gloria Naylor experienced. And if you Google her, N-A-Y-L-O-R, her book, 1996, which is a novel, but it's based on truth, and it's called 1996 because that's when her harassment began. And it began because she said she was living on an island off the coast of Maine, I believe, if I remember correctly, and she was staying at a friend's house, and the guy who was living next door was an intelligence agent, and he thought that Gloria Naylor had poisoned his cat. And soon after this, all this harassment starts with Gloria Naylor. And that becomes the book 1996, which I really recommend that people look at to see that there are parallels with her situation and with Damien's situation. So there are all these private security firms like InfraGuard, and there are companies like SAIC that are manufacturing this technology. And it's basically being used to surveil and harass people either who just get on someone's bad side. I mean, you could be driving on the freeway and accidentally cut off Lita Johnson on the freeway, and then suddenly you're on a list. It could be as random as that. Or in Damien's case, where they think that he's withholding information, or they're just pissed at him for not cooperating. So then they decide to use him as, and this is what Richard Schellinger thought, that they decided to use Damien as a guinea pig because they wanted to test this equipment in a real life situation where the subject didn't know what was happening. And I remember telling this at the time to one of my colleagues who teaches at CSU Long Beach. And she said, well, why wouldn't they just test it out at the military base? And I said, well, because you want to test it in a real situation where there's someone who doesn't know what's happening.
So that makes sense, unfortunately. It makes total sense, yeah.
So you can tell when the technology breaks down. Oh, he saw it. He saw it when he moved the mirror. Or, he saw the dots in there. The technology's not working. We need to refine that. You want to refine that before you deploy it in some sort of real situation, in a real combat situation. That's what Richard thought was happening with Damien.
Yeah, and anyone who wants to give us a call, I mean, the Skype line is open, so just call user CropFM, spelled just like the show, or just click on the icon on the start page. So, and I'm sure there are a lot of questions people might have, but a lot might just listen to it from the archive and then it's too late. But anyway.
And you know, to tie this back in with QAnon, it seems to me that QAnon was created to distract from real real conspiracies, real serious problems, unconstitutional surveillance and harassment of U.S. citizens. You know,
no, showing it as a good thing, yeah.
Showing it as a good thing, yeah. I mean, that with what they did with Comet Ping Pong, which is kind of like the Mordor of the QAnon scenario. Comet Ping Pong is supposedly the location of the pizza joint that was supposedly a cover for this pedophilia ring. There are people, you know, stalking and harassing that guy. People cyber stalking John Podesta. It's almost as if the entire world is being gang stalked now. You know, this entire situation that was happening with Damien was just him and Pacific Beach. Now they decided to do it to the entire planet all at the same time.
And I mean, yeah, and there is this rumor out that they might someday fake an alien invasion. And with that tech that apparently seems to exist, I mean, I don't know. Of course, we don't know for sure, but, well, we have Chris Marks, we have Damien, I'm sure there are other people, and accounts of invisibility technology. There's also people who see Predator-like technology, which is also quite close to this kind of invisibility technology. Maybe there are different kinds of, but using all of that stuff, you certainly could fake an alien invasion, couldn't you?
Well, David Politis, who writes the Missing 411 books, in his book on, it's called Missing 411 Hunters, he tells the story of the wife of Bruce McAbee, who's an optical physicist and the UFO researcher, and she claimed that she was in the woods and she actually encountered a predator-like.
Yeah, exactly.
I did a follow-up interview with Richard that was published in Nexus magazine, where I interviewed him about the origins of the technology. Where did he get the idea? And he's, you know, Richard Schellinger he's a 33rd degree Scottish Rite Mason. He's also a Rosicrucian. And he became a Rosicrucian when he was stationed on Guam. He said that it was going back to when he was a Rosicrucian, and he would read about these ascended masters who supposedly could become invisible. They could make people, convince people sort of hypnotically that they're not there, that you cannot see them. That mixed with later on
Jedi's,
in the 60s, when
so to say,
or the shadow, the pulp character, the shadow from the 1930s, he was able to do that, you know, become invisible through kind of hypnosis techniques. Richard Schellinger got into UFOs in the 60s, and he said he began to notice in a lot of the stories that the UFOs would suddenly zip out of existence, or seem to cloak themselves, or shift into another dimension. And this fascinated him. And so, in a way, the Richard Schoengrund's Camellio optical camouflage technology is a kind of cargo cult version of something that already existed. You know, it's like those old Tarzan movies where you would see the natives in the jungle and they've just built a plane out of bamboo and they're worshiping it. You know, it's like Richard studied the UFO phenomenon, thought, oh, how would you replicate that with what we have available to us now? Mm-hmm. So it's kind of like optical camouflage. The Camellio technology is the cargo cult version of something that actually exists. So it's not necessarily an either or situation. It might be a false dichotomy to say, well, is it real or are there actually UFOs? Are there actually aliens? It could be that a lot of the MyLab cases are in fact mind control programs where they're using this technology to make people think they're being abducted by aliens as a cover for this kind of mind control technology. But on the other hand, they could be mimicking something that, you know, actually exists.
Yeah. Someone in the chat, Sai, asks the question, if the U.S. has this technology, wouldn't that change the way countries interact slash spy slash fight each other? Crimea, Middle East, etc. Doesn't look like this is available. What's your take on this? Well, if that is available, wouldn't it be used? I mean, and how wouldn't we see this, or would this just be, you know, under the cover, and we will just see the result?
Well, yeah, you would just see the result. You wouldn't know it was being used, but I got contacted by a guy named Kevin, who is a attorney in Minnesota, and he contacted me. He actually came to meet me in my office on campus. This guy was a very successful attorney in Minnesota, and he had been representing an African-American Muslim woman who had a discrimination lawsuit against the St. Paul Police Department for discrimination. This guy, Kevin, he first encountered the optical camouflage technology in Minnesota, and he thought that that the police were using it against him. They're basically field testing it. They're trying to get back at him for having successfully sued the police department on behalf of this African American Muslim woman. And so in May of 2016 in San Francisco, he had to flee Minnesota. He had to leave his successful law practice behind him. The harassment became so crazy that he had to leave town. And he comes, he visits me in my office. We talked for several hours. And then he left and went to San Francisco. So in May of 2016 in San Francisco, he sends an essay to the ACLU in Minnesota detailing his harassment. And it was about 11 o'clock at night, after emailing the essay from like a Starbucks or something, he gets jumped by what he thought were at least four different invisible people on Harrison Street. And they were sort of sparkly. They were similar to the way Damien described them. In other words, he could see the sparks. He could see the footsteps on the gravel as they were coming at him. They chased him down the middle of the street near the ballpark there, and they put a bag over his head in an alley and started asking him all these weird questions, like who was the football coach for the Wayzata football team in 1983? Who was the quarterback? And if you don't answer correctly, I'm going to put a bullet in your head. And so they beat the crap out of him, and he ends up in St. Mary's hospital with a skull fracture. St. Mary's kicks him out without treating him, and he ends up at San Francisco General, and he spends about 6 days there. And when he tells the doctors what happened to him, they transfer him to the psych ward. Right?
Oh, my God.
And he spends 6 days there. Right, so when the psychologist sees him, it turns out the psychologist went to the University of Chicago for a psychology degree, and this guy Kevin, the lawyer, he went to the University of Chicago for a law degree. So the psychologist says, "You know, what the F are you doing here?" And Kevin says, look, there's been some misperceptions. I got beaten up. I just need to get out of here and go back to Minneapolis. And the doctor says, yes, you do. The cops hate you. You need to get out of town. That's what the psychologist tells him. And the psychologist had to escort him out of the hospital because the people at the front desk kept coming up with excuses why they couldn't discharge him. Finally, the doctor says, you know, you discharge this man now. And the Kevin, the lawyer, he thinks if not for the psychologist, he may never have left the psych ward, you know, not alive at least. So Kevin leaves and he walks about 15 blocks from the Tenderloin to 3rd and Folsom, which is a few blocks off Mission Street, and a car follows him the whole way home. And so Kevin tapes about 5 or 6 of these spoons around the frame of the door. So if anybody tries it, the spoons would just go flying onto the linoleum floor and he'd hear it. So at about 2 a.m., he wakes up to hear the spoons crashing on the floor and he screams, get the F out of here. And he runs into the kitchen. The door is wide open and the spoons are on the floor. So he stays up till about 6 a.m. He gets $300 from some friends and he goes to San Francisco International. He gets a one-way flight to Minneapolis and gets the hell out of town. And to this day, he's trying to rebuild his law practice, the one he was forced to abandon. And this was retaliation for winning a discrimination case.
But this is really, really frightening, because if you take this case, if that all happened as it happened, and I have no reason to believe other, then, I mean, not only do they harass him with exotic technology, beat him up, so he has to go to the hospital, but also the staff in the hospital is in on it. You know, this sounds like this even would sound weird on QAnon, but it, you know, but it happens. And what does that leave us with? I mean, what does that mean? You know, it's really confusing. On the one hand, you have those complete weird stories that are obviously faked. On the other hand, you have those complete weird stories that just freaking happened.
Well, of course, I think the difference is, like with Camilio, I mean, I have this whole interview with Richard Schoengert in there. Richard Schoengert is a real person. You know, you can look him up. Lev Berger, his partner, is an eminent physicist. I have an interview with him too, which I haven't published yet. There's actual evidence for what I'm saying. You know, yeah. I mean, I spoke to Lita Johnson. I spoke to her on the phone. I know that she's not some sort of hallucination that Damien was you know, making up in his brain. I actually spoke to her on the phone. I don't think I even mentioned that earlier. I actually, you know, she gave Damien her card. So I called her. I called the phone number, and it was right before Damien was planning on leaving town. And I called her and I said, hey, my friend Damien claims that you're following him. And she immediately asked me who I was, and she was flustered and seemed annoyed that I was calling and asking her these questions. The transcript of that call is in the book. And she would say all these weird CYA kind of words, phrases. For example, I would say, so, you know, is Damien accurate? Are your people following him? And she would say, oh, no one from my agency is currently following your friend. You know, in other words, she would say it in such a way that it was like a kind of a cover your ass kind of thing.
Weren't you frightened that they might turn on you as well? I mean, this is quite brave. I don't know if I would have done that. I surely wouldn't have called that spooky lady.
Well, there are odd incidents that I talk about in the book. And in fact, there's the part where Damien comes to my apartment in Long Beach and says, he tells me, you know, be careful of anyone new in your life, anyone new that you run into. Be very wary of trusting someone. And I thought he was being overly cautious. It was the next day, I think, or maybe a couple of days later, a friend of mine, I had met her in my first semester teaching at CSU Long Beach. She'd been a student, and she had moved back to New York, but she was in town for a couple of days. So she meets me. She gets on the bus, and I'm going to meet her at the corner of my where my apartment is. And when she gets off the bus, there's a guy with her, and I don't know who this guy is. And she says, "Oh, this guy, I just met this guy on the bus, and he's being very friendly, and he wants to take both of us to lunch at this place called 555, which is this very expensive restaurant." And he introduces himself and says that he lives in the neighborhood and that he takes the bus all the time and he is a dock worker. And I shake his hand, and his hand is like as smooth as a baby's bottom. He's got like manicured fingernails. I don't know what kind of a dock worker this is. But he then invites both of us to this expensive restaurant, which we're not even dressed for, really. And he says, "Oh, I have a contact. I know the maitre d'. He can get us in." I'm thinking that this is all weird, particularly in light of what Damien just told me a couple of days ago, but I'm trying to push it out of my mind. Like, don't be paranoid. So I'm waiting in line. At one point, my friend goes to make a phone call, and now I'm alone with this guy. And out of the blue, he starts talking about, he goes, "You know, I'm really into conspiracies. Have you ever read Behold a Pale Horse by Milton William Cooper?" And he actually said it by Milton William Cooper. You know, like, it's like people who are under UFOs, they don't call him Milton William Cooper, even though on the side of the book, that's what it says, Milton William Cooper. People say either Bill Cooper or William Cooper. You know, it's like a baseball fan calling Babe Ruth by his real name. And he starts going off in this whole, "Have you read that book?" And I go, "Oh no, I've never heard of it," which seemed to surprise him. And then he goes, "Don't you think we need a revolution in this country? You know, this is 2005. So George Bush is still president." He's like, "What about that George Bush? I think we need someone to take him out. What do you think? You know, where's Lee Harvey Oswald when you need him?" And it's like he wanted me to say, "Oh yeah, that's a great idea. Yeah, let's do it." And I was just like, "Oh no, I love George Bush. He's great, doing a great job. I voted for him twice, even though I did not vote for him." And he seems absolutely flustered by this, as if this is not going according to plan. And then we go into the restaurant, and he starts quoting from William Cooper, talking about the protocols of the Elders of Zion, and it's all about the Illuminati and not the Jews. And my friend is Jewish from Israel, so she's not, you know, warming up to this in any way. The lunch did not go according to plan, as far as I could tell. I wasn't eating or drinking anything because I thought, what's going on? You know, am I going to be poisoned here? So either this guy was like a really inept gang stalking government agent who was trying to get me to agree to an assassination plot on the president of the United States, or it was just some like crazy lonely guy who was trying to make a connection and failing miserably. So it's one or the other.
Yeah, you never know. So someone in the chat, Teuer Zuhörer, asks, "So what about the current situation? Where is this heading? Do we lose all our remaining freedoms, etc.?" So, I mean, I think I know where he's coming from, or she, I guess it's a he. Because, as you just outlined, I mean, it seems quite overwhelming. There is a lot of, I mean, if this is not all chance, which it could be, but okay, what are the odds of that all being pure chance? Very little. So if it's not just pure chance, then, I mean, how far is this gone? How do we get out of this? And what does this all mean, you know, in our current situation? And I don't have to point out in which situation we are right now worldwide. Maybe it's getting better, but...
Well, first of all, if there's anyone listening who is actually thinks they're being gang stalked, I recommend looking at a website called fightgangstalking.com. And if you go there and then you look in the left-hand side of the screen, you'll see a part that says tactics for fighting back. And it's just a series of very sort of simple, small things that one can do. And in fact, I would hope that if one read Camellio and you're going through a situation like this, you could kind of use it as a blueprint. You can kind of back engineer those moments where Damien is able to flip the script on him. Because these people are literally given a script and told to follow it. And so if something does not go according to plan, like when I told the guy who is William Cooper, they have no idea what to do. They're not good at jujitsu and going with the flow. They're not good at that at all. And there's been many times where Damien's been able to just flip the script on them. You can kind of use the book as like a back engineered way of how to deal with these people. Also, on a broader level, on the macro scale, and I talk about this in an article I published in the Evergreen Review back in November, the title of the article is Donald Trump's Operation Mindfuck. And it's an extension of the QAnon series I did for Salon. And in that article, I talk about how Walter Boart, in his book Operation Mind Control, in the revised edition that was published in 1994, talks about the importance of repealing the National Security Act of 1947 and, I would add, the Patriot Act of 2001, which should have been repealed by Obama, but was not, obviously. And Boart in there talks about how people thought it was impossible to repeal the Volstead Act, which was passed in the 1920s. And that was, of course, to people could not drink alcohol. It made drinking alcohol illegal, which, of course, simply created a black market in alcohol.
And made a lot of people rich.
Exactly. And it was eventually repealed in the 1930s. So it's not like these things have not been done before and cannot be done. It is possible to repeal the National Security Act of 1947. And Boart makes a very strong case that it is, in fact, unconstitutional because under the First Amendment, one is guaranteed freedom of speech. But if the National Security Act prevents you from even knowing what to talk about, then that's not exactly granting people freedom of speech. I told you before about seeing the UFO zipping around in the desert over 29 palms. Whatever that was defying all the laws of physics. So if tax dollars are being used to manufacture something that defies known physics, that is something that if you're keeping something like that secret, then that is obviously a violation of the First Amendment. And so, because as Walter says, if you don't know it exists, you can't talk about it. Therefore, it's actually suppressing freedom of speech. And so it's the National Security Act and the Patriot Act. And by the way, a lot of the gang stalking stuff that happened to Damien, keep in mind, this was 2003, July of 2003, this begins with Damien. So this is 2 years after 9/11. And a lot of the people I've spoken to, their experiences began soon after 9/11. So,
interesting.
I think a lot of this is as a result of the Patriot Act. They have to keep the money flowing in. They have an endless black budget. They have to justify it. Well, how do we justify it? Well, we need to watch potential terrorists. Oh, there are no potential terrorists. Well, then we need to create some. So we need to create a situation in which everyone is a potential terrorist. And so they have their little cryptopedia page where they surveil, watch you, write down everything that you're doing because they have to, because after all, you're a potential terrorist. And so, you know, you have 50 guys watching Damien while someone with a nuclear bomb strapped to his back is walking across the border behind them. The analogy I use, the very simple analogy I use in Camellio, is my very first tutoring job was at El Camino Community College in Torrance. And I was offered the job because I had very good grades in English. And the woman in the financial aid office said, we really need an English tutor. Would you like to work as an English tutor here? I said, oh, sure. When do I start working? You start this Monday. So I go in on a Monday and I sit in the room where they tell me to sit. And there's two other guys there and they're both playing video games and no one's coming in. There are no students. I turned to these two guys sitting next to me playing video games. They go, "Hey, who are you?" And they said, "We're the math tutors." And I go, "Are there any students? Like, what are we supposed to do?" And they just both laughed and went back to playing the video game. Eventually, they revealed to me that the entire purpose of this was that the financial aid department was given a certain amount of money every year, and they had to spend it by the end of the fiscal year. And so if they did not spend it, then they would get less money the next year. So they really had no need for a math tutor or an English tutor, or rather, if they did have a need, they didn't bother to advertise anyone that we were there. So we would sit there and just collect a paycheck because there were no students coming in for the services because they didn't know it existed. And so that parallel is exactly what's going on here. There's this massive black budget. You have to spend all the money. There's nothing to spend it on. Well, we need to create situations where we spy on people. So I think that's why a lot of the gang stalking stuff spiked right after 9/11 and the passing of the Patriot Act, yeah, which is something that could be repealed.
Someone also was asking repeatedly about 4/11 and all of this invisibility technology. So I think you already mentioned missing 4/11 cases. So obviously, there could be a connection there, couldn't there?
Yeah. In fact, David Politis, after I appeared on Coast to Coast, George Knapp sent a copy of my book to David Politis. Politis read it. And in fact, I've been told on numerous occasions that they've actually picked up Chameleon, bought it based on Politis's recommendation. He read the book and he's mentioned it in several different interviews. And he's said that, yes, he thinks that there could be a connection between Chameleon and the missing 411 cases.
Yeah. And since you just mentioned...
And in fact...
Yeah, go on.
Oh, well, it's interesting that some of the cases that Politis writes about, like there's a guy named, he mentions Todd Geib, G-E-I-B. He was one of these victims, and Politis mentions several of them, one of these missing 401 guys, who were found eventually with antidepressants in their system, even though they were not known to be taking antidepressants. They weren't prescribed by any doctor. And the particular antidepressant that he mentions, one is called amitriptyline, and another is called disipramine. And the side effects of these are delirium, confusion, and memory loss. Now, what's interesting about that is when I was talking, I interviewed Melinda Leslie for many, many hours, and she was telling me about her experiences with the not just the alien abductions, but the MyLabs. So this ties into, this is again, this is something that I think QAnon was created to distract from. Melinda describes being taken in Sedona during a mass abduction. Her and four other people in the same house were abducted on the same night together, all at once. They were taken to an underground base in Arizona. So it's not like there aren't underground bases. There are. Yeah. Richard Sauter's book, Underground Bases, is a good book to look at. So she's taken to an underground base. She didn't see the Illuminati. She didn't see people in black robes extracting adrenochrome from prepubescent females. Instead, what happened was that she and her friends were led into this underground base and given a series of strange tests as if they were testing them for psychic abilities. And it wasn't just her. There was about 100 people there that were all abducted on the same night. And they were all being given these tests. And afterwards, at the end of the experience, some of these military people gave Melinda and everyone else a little plastic cup with a white fluid in it. And they were told to drink it. And at first she tried not to, but then they're like, "Well, you know, you're not going home unless you drink this." So she drank it. And they put her and the other four of her friends into this little like minivan. And they start driving away from the base. And she tried to keep her eyes open and couldn't. whatever it was just made her go to sleep. And the next thing she knew, she was back in her bed. And so I'm wondering if in some of these cases,
didn't remember anything at first.
Now this is interesting. At first, no. But then when they all woke up again, remember, this wasn't just one person being abducted. Five people all living in the same house were abducted on the same night. Mm. And so afterwards in the morning, when they started comparing notes, memories started coming back. So I'm feeling that the fact that it was for some reason why they, I don't know why they abducted five people at the same time, but they did. And so as a result, they were able to compare notes and some of these flashes of memories were coming back for all of them. Whereas if it was just one person and you had no one to bounce off your memories off of it, yeah. You might not remember
it
much at all.
It just fades away. Yeah. Sure.
And so I thought it was interesting that these people, like this Todd guy, G-E-I-B, one of these missing 411 guys who went missing and then ends up dead. And there's this weird drug in his system, the side effect of which is memory loss.
Yeah.
Is some of these missing 411 cases situations where, oh, whoops, we gave him too much, or that wasn't supposed to happen. What do we do now? Well, we can't return him to where we found him. Let's just dump him here in the woods. Because I mean, it can't be that if that's going on as frequently as it appears to be, then it can't be that every single case goes smoothly.
No.
Yeah. So. You know, maybe some of these missing 411 cases are these people who something's gone wrong. They were given this antidepressant in order to suppress their memory, but then something went wrong, and so they couldn't return him to where they got him, so they just left him somewhere.
Camellia, obviously a groundbreaking book, I have to say. And one other thing I would like to mention from cryptoscatology is that just blew me away. You were talking about when you were a tutor in the school system, and you dug up that schooling was originally, so the way school is working right now with those breaks every 50 minutes that just push you out of whatever you are into and up to the next one. That was invented in Prussia, so Preußen in German, in the 1800s as a reaction that they lost the war to Napoleon, and they figured out it's because the soldiers didn't shoot, they didn't do what we told them, so they wanted to find out how can we stop people think for themselves, but just do what they're told. And then this guy, I forgot his name, just comes up with the school system. That is so, mind-boggling.
Yeah, that's the article called Concentration Campus.
Yeah.
Which is, I had that title ever since I was a teenager.
Great
title. Originally, it was going to be a short story, and then it turned into an article, and in fact, that's what it should have been all along. So yes, Concentration Campus, and that's all about what I call thought control as opposed to mind control in education, which I'm in a position to see the results of it because I often teach English 100 English composition, which is the entry level English class at the university level. So a lot of my students are 18 and they've just come out of the American public school system. And so I've been teaching since 2002. So I've seen the changes since 2002, it's been almost 20 years. And the students today are very different from the students in 2002. And it was during the Obama administration that they introduced something called Common Core. And one of the aspects of Common Core was to not assign as much fiction in the early grades. And to eventually, by the time you get to like fifth grade or something, fiction's totally gone. You're only supposed to assign nonfiction. And this attitude is trickled up into the university system, where I wrote a whole essay about this called Farewell Frankenstein in a book called Freedom of Screech, which was an anthology of stories that overlapped themes of horror and the First Amendment. And the Freedom of Screech was edited by Craig Spector. And the essay in there, Farewell Frankenstein, is all about the attempts to suppress the to prevent me from teaching Mary Shelley's Frankenstein to English 100 classes. And there's this entire attitude that you shouldn't assign any fiction or poetry in a composition class or in high school or in elementary school or in middle school. They say because, well, the purpose of schooling is to get you ready to for the job market. And what's fiction have to do with that?
Yeah, you have to function.
Well, they have to think. You know, that's the purpose of it, is that fiction and poetry teaches critical thinking, actually.
Yeah.
And interacting with the world on an aesthetic level that goes beyond, you know, what job am I going to get, and, you know. They say that that's the reason. See, I don't think that that's actually the reason. I think the reason is that if you don't teach fiction, people will not be able to recognize fiction later on when they become adults, when it's spewing out at them from the mouth of the president or a police officer or their parents or a psychiatrist or a doctor or whatever authority figure you want to put in there. And so that's the new thing. And so when I teach English, I teach, I've used Slaughterhouse 5 by Kurt Vonnegut. I've used The Scanner Darkly by Philip K. Dick. I've used Brave New World by Aldous Huxley. I use poetry by Charles Bukowski. I've used Hunter S. Thompson, Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. I had one student come up to me, and she said she had read Slaughterhouse 5, and she said, "This is amazing. This is the first time I've read a book." And I go, "What do you mean?" She goes, "The first time I've read a novel, like all the way through." I go, "Weren't you assigned novels in high school?" And she said, "Oh no." She had gone to this high school in the depths of LA. And she said how, like, every day the teacher would come in, he'd put on this defective VHS tape of a Snoopy movie, like Charlie Brown, and put that on, and then hit play, and then he'd go sit in the back of the room and read the newspaper. And meanwhile, everyone in the class would just, like, be lobbing grenades at each other. totally out of control. And the teacher had just given up, so he would just play the same Snoopy video over and over again every day. And she was actually angry. She was angry that, like, I had been teaching V for Vendetta, the graphic novel by Alan Moore and David Lloyd, which is about a future dystopian state in England, and I at one point was talking about dystopian novels, and I mentioned Fahrenheit 451 by Ray Bradbury, Brave New World 1984, and, you know, one person over here, they knew what Fahrenheit 451 was because it had been assigned in their high school. Another person knew Brave New World because it had been assigned in their English class. She didn't know any. She had never even heard of these titles. She had never heard of Fahrenheit 451. She had never heard of 1984. She had never heard of Brave New World. And she was angry about it. She's like, how come I don't know these things? You know, these other people know these things. Well, because a Common Core states that you can't teach fiction. You know, you have probably a few rebels here and there who are just teaching it, you know, on the sly. But otherwise, the attitude is no fiction. And I mean, if that's not mind control, I don't know what is.
Yeah. To end on a more positive note here, we also have some pictures from the Integratron. Integratron, yeah. Which is the fusion of art, science, and magic. Now that sounds interesting. So there are those on the picture page. It's, I think, picture 4-2.
Yes, I went there with Richard Schoenger.
4, 5, and 6. Yeah.
Richard Schoenger and I went to the Integratron, which was created by an alien contactee from the 1950s, named George Van Tassel. And George Van Tassel claimed that the aliens had given him the idea for the Integratron. It's an amazing experience when you're driving through the desert you know, and the desert looks like a Ralph Steadman illustration in Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. And then off in the distance, suddenly you'll see this glowing white dome, you know, reflecting the heat of the sun, the 40 heat of Joshua Tree. And as you get closer, this flying saucer-like construction becomes more clear. And so it's out in the middle of nowhere. And it's essentially this half dome kind of structure with a rim around it. And the acoustics inside are incredible. You can stand on one side of the room and whisper, and then the person on the other side of the building will hear clearly in their ear what you just said. He apparently was unfinished. If completed, it was supposed to do all these amazing anti-gravitic things. But it's being used now as a because the acoustics are so good, they do all these performances there. They do these meditation experiences there in the Integratron room. It's two stories, this huge dome. They have a museum there dedicated to George Van Tassel. And in fact, there's a documentary about George Van Tassel. I'm blanking now on the title of it, but I think I mentioned it in the blog post. And so you can see, the George Van Tassel's whole story and how.
And I think I linked it up, didn't I? Yeah, I linked up the blog post. Calling All Earthlings, it's called, yeah?
That's the title. Calling All Earthlings is the title of the documentary about George Van Tassel.
Yeah.
Yes, I highly recommend it. And, you know, we should go to the Integratron sometime.
Oh yeah. See, you know, I've never been to California, and that is just the best reason I ever had to finally go there.
Oh, absolutely. And it's very close to Giant Rock, the infamous Giant Rock, which is where all the UFO conventions were held.
And you know Richard you met Richard Hoagland, didn't you? I mean, you met...
My friend Randy, who I mentioned earlier, Randy Copang, he's very close associate with Richard Hoagland and used to do a lot of research for him. So he introduced me to Richard Hoagland one night at LAX, at the hotel next to LAX. There was a UFO exopolitics conference going on, and Richard spoke. I shook Richard's hand, which was kind of like it's kind of like meeting Paul McCartney or something.
yeah. I mean, really, that's... He's just, oh God, the city on the edge of forever. And of course, his latest book. I'm really waiting on another book from him. Well, that was really a fascinating journey you took us on tonight. So, pictures are there. I just realized I messed up the numbering of the pictures a little bit. So, picture 5 is in there 2 times. So the pictures with Damien actually start with index 7, not 6, as I mentioned earlier. But that's, yeah, I'll correct it, and so just no one really gets confused about that. Anyway, there are some new books out. There are 2 titles out, Bela Lugosi's Dead. So this is this famous actor. And Widow of the Amputation and Other Weird Crimes. Maybe a couple of words about those. They came out in 2020 or 2021 or late 2020.
No, came out just a month ago, both of them, through the miracle.
Okay, I thought. And I've linked them up under the teaser text, so anyone who's interested.
Yeah, I had 2 books that came out in the same week. Which wasn't planned. It just happened that way. And Widow of the Amputation and Other Weird Crimes is a collection of 4 novellas that all take place in different areas of Southern California. And they're designed to get weirder as you go along. And they touch on some of these things. I mean, fans of Freemasonry will recognize the widow in the title, Widow of the Amputation.
Sons of the Widow. That's what you guys call that yourselves?
That is the title novella, the main character of which is Charles Manson. And so if you want to know the truth about Charles Manson, throw away Helter Skelter and read Widow of the Amputation, which is fiction, but it's based on research and my own interest in the sort of esoteric underground of Los Angeles. And so it's about Charles Manson busting out of prison in 2004 and then stealing the frozen head of Mary Magdalene from a refrigerator in the California Bank and Trust building in Torrance, California. And then the story proceeds from there. Very much about Charles Manson's intimate knowledge with esoteric orders. He had far more knowledge of these things than I think most people are aware of. And so Widow of the Amputation, that's from Eraserhead Press. And then the other book that came out that same week was Bela Lugosi's Dead, which is a novel that takes place in 1980s Los Angeles that is all about the Bela Lugosi, the golden age of Hollywood. And it is in some way a noir mystery, in some ways a dark fantasy, in some ways a psychological thriller. I was pleased to get a very positive blurb from Alan Moore. Alan Moore, who wrote V for Vendetta and Watchmen. Mm. He rarely gives out blurbs, but he gave out a blurb for this particular novel. Yes, those are my two latest books. And the next book coming out probably will be a book-length version of the QAnon series. And I'm also working on a book called Hollywood Haunts the World, an investigation into the cinema of occulted taboos is the subtitle.
And the latter one...
100 years of film history.
100 years of Hollywood. Yeah, the later one really sounds fascinating, so I'm surely going to pick up that one. Someone has been asking all along, can you make those, just going back to the invisibility thing, can you make those people visible again by spraying color on them or something like that? I guess yes, because they're not really invisible. They are still there. They're just camouflaged in a very clever way, aren't they?
Yes, absolutely. In fact, that's when Damien fled, being followed by drones, by the way, at a time.
Yeah, UFO drones. That also, of course, is there, yeah.
He ended up in Winona, Kansas, which is extremely small town. It's got like 100 people living in it. And when he moved there, the gang stalking stopped. And we wondered if it was because it was such a small town, you couldn't get away with a parade of jarheads following you.
Really? A parade of them? That's the frightening thing, yeah.
And also, you know, the invisibility technology does not make you bulletproof. So everyone in Winona, Kansas has a gun.
Yeah.
Perhaps that was another reason why. So yes, you can. In fact, at one point in the interview, in the book, Richard speculates and Damien speculates as well that perhaps the reason they wanted the night vision goggles back, like what was so special about them? That maybe when you put on these particular goggles, you could see through the optical camouflage. Like maybe that's what their purpose was and how it tied in with the invisibility technology. Now that's speculation. Don't know if that's true or not, but that was something that Richard and Damien discussed during that initial interview.
So any last minute calls, do them now or don't. And one question from Tom that I think is, yeah, it's interesting. So what happened to Damien?
Oh, okay. So Damien, I mentioned that he kind of went into a spiraling depression after the Richard Schoengert interview. I lost touch with him for a couple of years, then got back in touch with him. He had moved to the Lost Coast area of Humboldt County, which is where his mother was living at the time. And when he moved there, suddenly all the drones that had been following before suddenly moved in on this area. Now, Humboldt is, that's where a lot of illegal marijuana farming goes on. And so a lot of these marijuana farmers thought that the drones were like being sent in by the DEA or something. So they were coming out with their rifles and shooting these things. And Damien was, you know, sort of just kept it to himself. That, oh no, this happens all the time. It's, I'm sorry. It's because of me. And so eventually he moved from Humboldt. A lot of the same harassment started happening again in terms of, it got so bad at one point in San Diego that he had gone down to, he looked like a scarecrow. I mean, he looked like, you know, Auschwitz victim. He was urinating blood. He had a metallic taste in his mouth, which I learned later on was a symptom of electromagnetic poisoning.
Yeah.
Some of that started happening to his dog when he was living in Humboldt. So he decided to bail out of Humboldt. And at one point, he was living in an apartment in the Pacific Northwest. And what he described one day, he was making some iced tea. And he was, you know, he had put it in the windowsill like all day. And it was done. And now he was going to open it and he was going to drink it. And suddenly, for no reason, he took it and he poured it over his own head.
God.
And now this is something that is reported by, I mentioned Melinda Leslie before. She reported something very similar to me. She had appeared on Coast to Coast in 2000 when it was being hosted not by Art Bell and not by George Norrie, but the guy who came in between them. It was a year there where it was.
I forgot his name. Art kicked him out again. He was terrible. Even worse than George Norrie, which is quite a feat.
So he that guy was interviewing Melinda. And Melinda was in San Diego staying with her friend Misha, who also is a MyLab alien abductee. After they got off the phone, after the interview, they went to bed. And then they got up in the morning because they had to drive to San Francisco for a UFO convention where they were both going to speak. So Melinda gets up. She plugs in the hairdryer. She turns on the faucet. And without wanting to, she starts holding the plugged-in hairdryer under the running faucet, which could obviously electrocute her. She did not want to be doing this, but her arm was doing it.
Oh my God.
Misha, her friend, reported a similar thing to me when I spoke to her. Misha said that she was in traffic, she was driving, and suddenly she put her foot on the gas to go through a red light, and she didn't want to be doing that. It was soon after that she got out of researching this stuff for a while. Now she's back into it, and she actually has a radio show in Las Vegas. But for a long time she stopped because of that and other incidents. Someone pushed her off the side of the road one day. Another incident with Melinda was Melinda had parked the car at a parking structure on the top level, and she suddenly started walking towards the edge as if to jump off. But she didn't want to be doing that. And then she was able to stop herself right at the last second.
Oh, my God. That is so scary. I mean, wow.
This kind of – and also Damien, one day he was just flung out of bed. Or rather, he flung himself out of bed and rammed into the wall.
Oh, my God.
And his roommates came in and were like, what the hell happened? And his computer was like, you know, crashed onto the ground. And he just suddenly said – he goes, oh, I was sleepwalking. I tripped. You know, how do you explain, against my will, I flung myself against the wall.
Yeah, you better not try to explain that, no.
Yeah, yeah, and it was those, he unfortunately got evicted from where he was living for a variety of different reasons, and all of his possessions were sold. In fact, I got an email from someone who was looking for my second book, Spies and Saucers, which is a collection of three novellas that all take place in the 1950s and involve the contactee period. And they were looking for a copy online, and they bought a hardcover signed copy of it from a thrift store in the Pacific Northwest. And they were surprised when it arrived. They sent me a photo of the first page, and it said, "To Damien, who knows more about spies and saucers than most, Robert," and with the date. And I realized that this was Damien's copy that I had signed to him. and they realized it was Damien too, because they'd heard interviews with me talking about Damien. They said, "Is this Damien's copy?" And I said, "Yeah, you got Damien's copy."
He sold you a signed book.
Unbelievable. Well, no, no. when he got evicted from the apartment, they sold all his stuff. So Damien, he was living under a freeway overpass in a tent. The tent caught on fire. He ended up in the hospital. He was just recently released. He had third degree burns. When he was in the hospital, two of the other people who were camping with him, one woman burned in a fire. The other one disappeared and took all of Damien's stuff with him. There's another guy who I spoke to, whose name was David, who was camping with him, young guy. And he tells me how when he first started camping with Damien and hanging out with him, he thought that all the attitude and the craziness that was going on, it was a result of being homeless, because he was new to this whole situation. He thought, is this how homeless people are treated? In other words, he thought the gang stalking stuff was just people being assholes to them because they were homeless. Later, he separated from Damien and was on his own, and he didn't get that treatment at all. And he realized, oh, wait, this is because I was with Damien. And then he found my book, and he was reading it. He wanted to contact me and let me know that, you know, he had seen this independent confirmation of what of what Damien was describing. If where is Damien? I mean, at the moment, he's homeless.
Oh, my God. Last question for tonight. How do you start your own secret society?
That's it. You know what? I wrote a story about that. The story is called Dr. Apocrypha's Manifesto. And it was published in a magazine called Shimmera World in England. In fact, I plan on including it in a short story collection that I'm working on. It's all about it's a manifesto on how to start your own secret society.
So anyone who wants to know, read the story.
Yes, which will be in my short story collection, which will come out hopefully soon.
Okay. Because it might be a good idea. I don't know.
I think it is. I think it's a very vital idea.
Yeah.
I mean, that's why the Illuminati, the historical Illuminati, the real one that Adam Weishaupt started in Germany, the reason he started it was because of dealing with the strictures of academia that bothered him and his fellow Illuminists at the time. It was a way of getting around the red tape and the bureaucracy of the academic world in which he was in. So he formed a secret society.
Now that's a very different view on the Illuminati, I would say.
Well, yeah, well, it's very. There's a book called by James Billington called "Fire in the Minds of Men." James Billington was in charge of the Library of Congress for many years, and he wrote this book. It's not a conspiracy book. Well, it is, but it's not marketed that way. It's a mainstream historical scholarly text, but it's all about the importance of secret societies in the French Revolution and the American Revolution, and when I hear fundamentalist Christians saying, oh, the Freemasons, they started the American Revolution and they had something to do with the French Revolution. And I think, and that's a bad thing. Why exactly? So the secret societies were used to foment democracy. Yes, that's true. The Freemasons did indeed have a lot to do with that. And I don't see that as a bad thing.
No, me neither, actually. But, you know,
I recommend
different opinions on the
Manly P. Hall's book, The Secret Destiny of America, which is all about the Freemasons and the early development of the United States.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a whole other show, actually. And I mean, there are dozens of shows we could do. Just if I would go through all my notes for today that I didn't get to it at all, but that's fine. It was, as I said, a fantastic journey. Thank you very much for being guest on my show. I hope we can do it again.
Absolutely.
That would be great. You got a lot of really cool books. And as I said, the one about Hollywood is really fascinating, but Well, I mean, we could just do just another one next week, actually. So I hope we'll be in touch, and thank you very much. And yeah, say hello to Damien. And
I will.
And all the best for your work.
I thank you, and I can't wait to see you at the Integratron.
Oh, yes. Well, I mean, careful. I mean, I might actually come. So, yes.
Yeah, you should.
Yeah, that would be really fascinating. Okay. And, yeah, I hope we meet again, either virtually or maybe in person even. And, yeah, thanks. And have a nice day in California. Long Beach. Oh my God.
it was fun. Despite the dire seriousness of some of the subject matter, I enjoyed it.
I enjoyed it very much. Okay. Thanks. And bye.
Thank you.
Okay. Bye.
Crop FM. Glaubt, was ihr wollt.
Und wie ja schon erwähnt, ist mein nächster Gast Ilo Brandt von Ludwiga. Ich freue mich auch ausgesprochen auf diese Sendung, und es geht um... Es geht ums Eingemachte eigentlich. Also ich, ja, es könnte wirklich eine, vielleicht das interessanteste Interview werden, das ich je mit ihm gemacht habe, und nicht, dass die vorhergehend nicht interessant gewesen wären. Es geht um die mutmaßliche Intention der Besucher. Irgendwo auch natürlich aufbauend auf den IGAP-Bericht Nummer 3, den ich gerade gelesen habe. Sehr spannend. Und wie gesagt, also er geht da wirklich ziemlich ans Eingemachte. Freue mich riesig darauf zu hören, ist das Ganze am 4. Juni 2021. Bis dorthin bedanke ich mich bei allen fürs Zuhören und fürs Interesse. Bis zum nächsten Mal. Bis zum 4. Juni. Macht es gut.